Support for Boston Public Radio comes from North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org.
Today on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, because of the government shutdown, garbage cans are festering and rats are taking to the streets, but why aren't we? We open the lines and ask you, where are the protests? If the Yellow Vests in France can sustain outrage for nearly 2 months, why aren't we putting pressure on the government to open for business? And after firing almost all its black coaches, the NFL's hiring practices are coming under scrutiny. Trini Kuznarek joins us to talk about what's going to take to get more minority coaches into the pipeline. And then the ACLU's Carol Rose is here to talk about the legality of not paying federal employees who work.
The Department of Agriculture is among the 9 federal agencies that's currently closed. If the government shutdown persists, that could mean millions of people on food stamps could be hit particularly hard. We'll talk to food writer Corby Kummer about this and other food headlines next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Tuesday. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hey, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So on November 17th, protests spontaneously erupted throughout France with tens of thousands of people blocking roads with rallies against the rising price of fuel. 2 months on, the yellow vests, as they're called, persist. But where is the outrage here? Raring what could be the longest government shutdown in history, federal employees are having to work without pay, lines at the airport are getting longer because TSA workers are calling in sick, states are still recovering from natural disasters, they're now further under siege, rats are feasting off trash that isn't being collected, and with the Department of Agriculture closed for business, the threat that food stamps, we're going to talk to Corby Kummer about this later, the threat that food stamps for millions of Americans could be put on hold is becoming increasingly real, and yet no protest. Nobody's blocking Mitch McConnell's office or the Senate chamber. House Democrats aren't staging sit-ins, and we can't even scrounge up a protest hashtag. Why do we have such a high threshold for injustice and ineptitude in this country? 877-301-8970. And if you're a federal worker, we would love to hear from you. If you've been affected by the shutdown, we want to know. If you're mad but not mad enough to do something about it, why? You know, a couple of things I was reading in the last 24 hours. When GM, when General Motors cut a ton of jobs, there were far more jobs cut in the United States than in Germany. Yet in Germany, 15,000 people protested at GM headquarters. You know how many people protested at GM headquarters in the United States?
None.
Not a one. There was a story out of this place called Mariana, Florida.
Oh, I mean,
there's
so many outrages. This is the worst.
This is a place where the roof was blown off the prison.
Yeah.
A federal prison
in
October. And as a
result, Hurricane Michael.
Was it Michael?
Yes.
As a result, the prisoners had to be transferred, I think, to another facility in Georgia.
Yazoo, Mississippi.
Okay, so not only are the correctional officers not being paid, which is obvious, the correctional officers who have to travel the 400 miles or whatever you just said it was.
Yeah, 7-hour drive.
They have to pay for gas, lodging, all that kind of stuff, and they can't even get it reimbursed. So they're not only not being paid, this is prison guards, but they're doing out-of-pocket hundreds of dollars per trip and not being reimbursed
and
by the federal government.
These are people who may have lost homes or parts of homes
in the hurricane.
Remember how it hit the panhandle?
I do indeed.
And it was just absolutely a disaster? That's really horrible.
Tens of thousands of federal mortgage applications that were pending are not going any further. People may lose that. You know the only good thing coming out of this?
What?
Is the EPA is shut. I mean, so they can't do any more damage. But I am serious. It is.
Emissions have gone up this year.
What's
you
that?
Know? Emissions
I know
have
that.
Gone up this
but
year.
But you
Terrible.
Have been relentless about this through the last year, mostly off the air. Mm-hmm. We are the most injustice-tolerant people in the world. I mean, the notion that people are not taking to the streets, virtually every aspect of our lives, even though only 25% of the government is shut down, virtually every aspect of our lives is affected. And as we're going to discuss, as I said, with Corby Kummer in an hour or so, we are potentially just a few weeks away from food stamps being halted to millions and millions and millions of not just poor people, but poor working people in this country. And apparently, other than tweeting about it, we do absolutely
or yelling,
nothing.
Or yelling at the TV.
Maybe that's
it. We're good at
it.
That, too. Well, it's a paradox.
Meaning what?
Well, because we are, you know, a nation armed to the teeth. We have all these guns, and we're ready to shoot everybody in moment's notice. But we are passive and get rolled over and lied to and cheated by our government kind of all the time. Very interesting analysis that I read over the weekend, the New York Times, talking about the shame of the middle class that differentiates us from Europe, that everybody here kind of thinks that they're middle class, whether they're a millionaire or whether they're
Because we think we're upwardly mobile.
That we're on the way to becoming those millionaires, whereas a lot of the Europeans think of more of themselves class warfare.
Exactly.
You know, Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake, and they're out the great proletariat out there. So they're more ready to go to the street and admit that they're broke, and we are not quite so ready to do that, even though a lot of us are. Look at all these federal workers. I mean, it's really horrifying to think that there are tens of thousands of people who have full-time jobs and their spouse has a full-time job, and yet they're working paycheck to paycheck because of the way the system, as Elizabeth Warren likes to say all the time, is rigged against
the
middle class.
Say it's more accurate to say they're working no paycheck to no paycheck.
Well, right now, no paycheck.
One last thing before we get to your phone calls. It was a great point made, a pretty obvious point, but one I haven't thought about. You know, the Border Patrol people, for the most part, not being paid. So essentially, Donald Trump has shut down the government because of his concern for an emergency at the border. And what is he creating with the shutdown? An emergency at the border. And you know the one thing that was also not considered at all, and I'm so glad I read about this in a story about the Secret Service not getting paid this morning in the Times or the Washington, New York Times or the Washington Post. Does anybody think about morale? I mean, if you are a worker who is living paycheck to paycheck, you have no idea. The President of the United States, who is your ultimate boss, said the other day this could go on for months or years. How do you go to work every day knowing you're not getting paid and having no idea when the end date is?
I think that's why some people, I mean, the TSA union people have talked about this, how morale was not great there.
Are they on the streets or just calling in sick?
A lot of them are calling in sick and they're not getting paid. I think it's very, very difficult for people. You know, look at these IRS people now that they've reversed themselves, now realizing.
On the refunds?
Yes, the IRS people are going to be forced to go to work to make sure they get the refunds out in time, but they're not going to be paid either while they're waiting. I mean, they've got to resolve this soon because I do think that we will reach a breaking point soon. Jim
Well, but how can you say that in light of what the topic is? What is the evidence that the American people are reaching a breaking point? What we do better than anybody in the world is complain. What we don't do better than anybody in the world is stand up for our rights. The fact that there are outside our window, that Boylston Street is not filled with people.
Well, I am concerned
about
the overflowing garbage and the rats. Thank goodness.
In D.C., though, that's great because the national.
Local people here in Boston are picking up the garbage. We don't have to worry about that.
You know, the analysis that I read, and then we will get to your calls, as to why we are so protest averse and so injustice tolerant, I guess, is one that we are the most individualistic of Western nations. That sort of fits into your notion about the perception that lower middle income people believe they're upwardly mobile,
shame.
Even
like
if
we
they're
feel
not.
It's our fault.
Well, not
as
only
opposed
that,
to feeling that the system is unfair.
And secondly, we have virtually no unions in the private sector anymore.
Right.
It's in the 5 or 6% range of people in the private sector who are organized in a union, so they can't spur that activity. Whatever it is an embarrassment, and one of the reasons why they're willing to crap on us in Washington is because they know that we're not going to do anything in return. Let's start in Braintree with Paul. Paul, you are first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Marjorie.
Hey.
Happy days. Happy days are here again.
They are.
Brother, can you spare a dime? Sometimes just read the lyrics of that song. Mm-hmm. First we built a railroad. It goes on. I think Trump has succeeded in one thing, and that is wearing the populace down. You know, we've just been bombarded for nearly 3 years now, and I think, you know, people are just laying on the ground. I hope after tonight, when he spreads his lies at 9 o'clock, things will change. But as an answer, I would like to see the Congress or some senator or congressman consider a constitutional amendment that would prevent the government from ever closing down again for budgetary considerations. I just heard on PBS this morning this really only started in the 1970s, and it was basically just on a ruling from some judicial, from some lawyer within the judicial system.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember there was one in
Obama's time, and there was one
in Clinton's time.
But we're reaching the all-time record, by the way. I think it's 21 days. Hey, Paul, thank you for the call.
That's the other thing that's so bizarre about tonight. You know, the big story is how networks are going to get it, because Trump does keep lying about the border, and he keeps lying, his minions keep lying about the border, and he's not differentiating between the people that are coming here to seek asylum, which is legal, and the illegal immigrants. And you mentioned before the crisis, my favorite podcast, The Daily talked about this beautifully this morning, that the crisis at the border is now the crisis of children and families that are overrunning the facilities down there, because there's been no effort to build more facilities, so people aren't – it's not a crisis of terrorists coming across the border. They keep lying about that over and over.
Well, the New York Times editorial today basically saying that one of the things that Trump is best at is creating a crisis and then suggesting he has a way to fix the crisis that he has created.
What the networks have to do tonight – is make sure that they either, and we'll talk about this with John King, either fact check in real time the lies he's going to tell, which is really bizarre to think about this.
How great would that be under the scroll, under
not
at
true,
the bottom
not
of the
true,
screen?
Not true, not true. Or they have to make sure they get a rebuttal afterwards or something. Because
well, a lot of the networks have it. I just read this morning before we went on the air, a bunch of the networks, including CNN, have granted the request from Schumer and Pelosi that there be a rebuttal. So,
but how strange is that? That you have this situation where you are so used to someone lying to you over and over again.
The leader
the president,
of the country. Yeah.
That you have to be arming yourself to rebut the lies.
Bernier, you're in Wahide Park. It's great to talk to you as always. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. Happy New Year, guys.
And Merry to you, Bernier.
I have 2 points that I really would like to make. The first one is to answer your question about why is it in this country that people are not outraged and protesting. I'm not surprised at all, because the first point I want to make is that, let's say you want to be a Catholic, you have to go to catechism. In this country, civic education is not taught. I mean, I cannot believe that they're not teaching civics to the practitioners of democracy tomorrow in the schools. This is an abdication of our duties. The Democrats should look long-term, and the Republicans as well, to push for civic education. People don't know how the government works. They don't understand how committees work. They don't understand anything.
That's Bernier, before you leave that point, I hate to inject a little optimism into that point.
Yeah, we did it, right?
Is two things. One, Massachusetts, I believed at the end of the summer, maybe it was in the fall, finally implemented a law requiring some level of civics education, even though it isn't a graduation requirement. I was also, by chance, for reasons I'll mention in a few days, talking to former Governor Swift yesterday, and she mentioned that she's working with this guy who used to be president of Dickinson College or University, I'm not sure which it is, who is trying to fashion a federal law that would require the exact thing that you're talking about. So maybe help is on the way. What's your other point, Bernier?
The other point is people keep talking about Donald Trump as though he is the only member of the government. We have a trinity of a government here. The legislature should just be pressured to override this nonsense that Trump is not going to sign the bill. The Congress can open the government if it wants to. So people need to lay off this.
Well,
be
clear.
President.
They can override the president, if they develop the backbone and have enough votes to override a presidential
action. So we need to pressure them, not just Donald Trump. They
That's
need
a good point.
The Senate to take up the Democrat bill and then override the stupid nonsense. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, well, they have
agree
put
with
forward
every word, Bernier. Thanks for the call, as always.
Pelosi did put forward that bill that would allow the government to reopen, except for Homeland Security, while they debate the wall.
You know, one of the things I want to ask John, you mentioned John King. I do this almost all the time with Congress people on our show. What are Republicans who have brains thinking about this? You know, Susan Collins, as always, is toying with taking a position like Cory Gardner, a Republican from Colorado, has. We should reopen the government, border wall or no border wall. Did the vast majority of these Republicans actually buy this? or they're just scared of Donald Trump.
Well, I think they're hoping that the Democrats are going to get blamed for this, or it's going to be a pox on both their houses kind of thing, that eventually people are going to be just as mad as the Democrats as they are at the Republicans, and it will be a wash in terms of their political the political damage. That's what I suspect they're thinking, because they haven't obviously had the you-know-whats to rise up even on something like this. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Carrie in Providence. Hi, Carrie.
Hello, Carrie.
Good morning. I'm calling today because everyone has been speaking about all of the federal workers that are out of work.
Yep.
But I am a contractor with the USDA, and I haven't worked since December 29th. I work about 80 hours per two-week pay period, and I'm not getting a check next week.
Well, wow. Also, Carrie, it's even worse, as you know better than I. Unlike the government workers, people who work for the government directly, not contractors like you, who in all likelihood, even though it isn't guaranteed, will get a check once this is over, you are unlikely to get a check once it's over. You're just going to be unpaid for this period. Is that not an accurate statement?
Exactly true. Exactly true. And what will happen is, what I do is I go out to grocery stores and enroll them in the food stamp program.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, people who have benefits can go in and use them. And what will happen is right now there's a backlog being created. So once the government reopens, I will not have one single moment to myself for, I'm guessing, upwards of a month. Because all of those jobs still need to be done. They're just sitting in a queue somewhere waiting to be distributed. So, yeah, it's going to be a really bad situation.
I am really glad you called, Curry, because we should have mentioned that contractors are not only getting not paid, like Curry, but are not only unlikely, will not be paid retroactively. And it's not just, and Curry, thanks for the call, it's not just contracts. You read the story about Ogden, Utah, and this is not atypical. Ogden, Utah is a place, I think it's right outside Salt Lake City, which has 4,000 federal employees who are affected by the shutdown. And, you know, this is obvious, but you don't think about it. All the small businesses are being affected because the 4,000 workers which is a huge part of the population, don't have accessible cash to be spending at the stores like they ordinarily would. So the trickle-down impact of this mindless shutdown is being felt by private sector people, by contractors like Curry, et cetera.
I did see the story about the small businessmen, the small diners, like the guy that in Denver that he's works at the federal center and he's got no one there.
Right, exactly.
He's making, you know, egg sandwiches in the morning and grilled cheese at lunch and stuff like that, and nobody's coming because nobody's at the office, and so he's in a big mess too, and he's not going to get the money back either. Okay, we're talking about this this mess with the shutdown. We're asking why Americans have become so lousy at civil disobedience and the art of the protest. We're going to keep talking about this on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio Live, as we are every Tuesday from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
I spoke with one tribal leader who said that they actually lost a tribal member because they were unable to plow the roads so that an emergency service vehicle could get to him in time. Literally, lives are at stake because the federal government is not up and running in the way that it's supposed to be.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. That's the voice of Congresswoman Charisse Davids on National Public Radio, talking about how the government shutdown is affecting Native American tribes. Our number is 877-301-8970. We're broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about what became of an American pastime, protest, and when did American passivity set in amidst this government shutdown that is having more serious consequences by the day. We essentially seem to be doing nothing but tweeting. 877, I'm serious, 301, 8970. Where is the outrage? I mean, we always quote Juliet, pace the outrage. It's not about pacing. Yeah. There's no outrage. There is literally, social media is the, in some ways, the worst thing that could ever happen, because I think people feel like they're doing something, and they're doing something, but not enough, by tweeting about how upset they are with Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell or the Democrats or whatever.
CNN is reporting that Pelosi and Schumer together are going to deliver the Democratic response to Trump's speech. I don't think that's a great idea.
Well, whatever. 877-301-8970. And I'm assuming, could one of our producers let us know? I assume we are carrying both the president's speech tonight and the Democratic response. You know, please let us know.
It's like the boy who cried wolf is going to be on primetime TV tonight. You know, it's incredible, really, when you think about it, this moment, right?
No, what's incredible...
Everybody's so sure he's going to lie through his teeth over and over
what's
again.
What's incredible is there is literally going to be a crawl across the bottom of your screen. I'm guessing at least on CNN. We'll ask John in a while, John King, which is fact-checking the president as he is speaking.
And by the way, I'm always somebody that's criticizing Fox News, as I've often criticized, all the time criticized the president, so I try to, you know, shout them out when they do good things. Chris Wallace.
He was brilliant with Sarah
Fox
Sanders.
The Fox News reporter who was brilliant with Sarah Sanders, where she tried to sell this load of baloney about 10 terrorists coming across the southern border.
No, 4,000 terrorists she talked about. 4,000. And he was prepared for that thing.
Coming across in one day?
No, not coming across in one day.
Because that's the other line. That we had 10 terrorists coming across the southern border every single solitary day. And he went right back at her. And she just kept repeating the lie thing over
and
over
again. He was
great.
I loved his candor. He said, well, I didn't know if you were going to bring this up, but I was prepared for it. And I did some research. And you're wrong. I mean, he's misstating where the problem was. Michael in Boston, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about our passivity in this country in the face of a lot of serious problems.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So my thoughts, and I'm a furloughed federal employee.
You are.
I think, yes, I am. So I'm enjoying my time at home. But what I would say is if you're going to shut the government down, you should actually shut it down. And I think there's a few things that result from this. One, I've had countless neighbors and friends coming up to me saying, well, it doesn't seem to matter. It's not affecting me. And I'm saying, well, that's because when we shut it down, we do these phony shutdowns. Commercial air travel continues. International imports continue. So you have customs officers out working without pay. You have TSA screeners without pay.
Yeah.
What we should do is, and don't get me wrong, the consequences would be grave, but they should be. If you're going to shut down the government, it should actually be shut down. One, the average American would soon see and appreciate all that is done for them by the federal government, much of which is unseen to them. And two, but since the consequences would be so grave, our elected officials would not allow it to happen. They would have to be brought to the table, come to a compromise, and allow the government to continue to operate.
Michael,
so
that
is my thought.
That is
a point.
Brilliant phone call, and particularly the part that you mentioned. I mean, not only your strategic thought about shutting the whole thing down, but it is true. If you stop 10 people in the street and ask them what the federal government does for them, their answer would probably be nothing. You are right. People don't appreciate.
Can you imagine?
Thanks, Michael. That was a great call.
Right, he's so totally right. Can you imagine if there was one day you couldn't get out of Logan, you couldn't get out of JFK, that the airports were shut down?
Well, let me tell you something. The TSA people are calling in fairly large numbers, calling in sick at almost twice the normal absentee rate. The first paycheck is what, this Friday? Is that what it is coming up here that they will have missed? Once a paycheck is formally missed, if they have not ended the shutdown by that day, which I think will be close to the record day, 20 or 21 or whatever it is, you don't think that there are going to be massive call-ins of sick? By the way, you know who should call in sick? The Secret Service. The Secret Service is under a more serious strain than I believe they've been under any president because there's so many members of the extended Trump family. No, I mean, he's entitled to that, who are getting protection. And they're going to work and not getting paid. They're protecting the lives of the president and his family,
well,
and they're not getting paid.
That's the other irony here, is that while we're supposedly have a national security crisis at the border, which we don't really have, we're creating a national security crisis in terms of the TSA, in terms of the inspections at the ports of entry, which is where most of the drugs do come in, not over the southern border from Mexico. And we're not – those people are not at their job, or if they're at their job, they're demoralized.
Well, I said earlier, most of the border protection people are not getting paid.
Right.
And that's it is border security that theoretically prompted this shutdown. And we're going to hear more about it tonight from the president. But it is really, it is obscene. And by the way, even though I think a fair-minded case would say the bulk of the fault here is Donald Trump's, it really is an indictment. And all you Democrats out there, you can send me all the angry emails you want. The best manifestation of how totally dysfunctional the whole federal government is. If the so-called blame by the bulk falls on Donald Trump, but the reality is the fact that nobody has the ability to pull things, there are no grown-ups in the room. It is really Pathetic.
Although, in defense of the Democrats, what are they supposed to do? Give them the wall?
I don't know what they're supposed to do. I mean, remember last year when they had that gun protest that lasted about a minute and a half because they had to go home?
Yeah.
They had a sit-in until forever until they had to go home for July 4th recess. Why don't the House members who are so upset about this, why don't they sit in? Why don't they go demonstrate at the White House? Why not? I mean, something out of the ordinary to get the attention of this public. I'm sure Schumer and Pelosi are going to do a fine job tonight in the response, but this is a time for extraordinary measures, and we're not taking
and
any.
And also,
neither
you know,
our leaders nor the people.
A few of the Congress people have voluntarily given up their salaries, but most of them haven't. I mean, maybe that would be another thing, too. Every single
one of them should.
The elected officials should not be paid either.
877-301-897.
They have to drive 400 miles from the panhandle to go to a prison in Mississippi, and then even get reimbursed for their gas.
You don't read as much on Twitter as I do, but Britt Hume from Fox News was complimenting the president for not taking his salary, which he doesn't take. And obviously, you know what the response was. Theoretically, he's worth billions of dollars. If you're worth billions, you can probably... What is the salary now? 400 grand or something?
I don't know.
Probably do without the 400.
Well, he's never taken it.
I know,
has he?
Exactly.
It's not like a new thing.
No, exactly. But his point was he's not getting paid was, I guess, the theory.
Roger from Marblehead. Hi, Roger.
Hello, Roger.
Hi, good morning.
Hey.
I just wanted to say that, first of all, it's great that you're calling people to arms, if you will, on this issue, because... Really, what I think needs to happen is you need to start crowdsourcing large groups to shut down Trump Tower in New York. You need to shut down the Trump International Hotel in Washington. You need to surround and shut down Mar-a-Lago. And you need to sit there with the barricades and the burning tires until this thing comes to an end. At the very least, just shutting down the hotel in Washington will probably cost Trump billions in emoluments that he won't be taking in from the Saudi government during that period.
Oh, Roger, I wish I had said every word that you did. That was a great call. Thank you very much for making it.
Well, there were. Remember the first days after he was elected? There were those massive crowds protesting outside Trump Tower in New York. Remember that?
Yeah. And what were we doing at Trump Hotel in Washington? Were we protesting?
No, we were in there scouting it out. Check it out. If you go into, I don't know if it's still, because we were there 2 years ago, so I don't know if they still do it now.
This is during inauguration week.
We went down there inauguration and went to this really snazzy, it's this beautiful hotel.
It
really is. And in the lobby, they have these huge containers full of iced champagne.
No, they're carts that move around. They're pushed around. Very expensive
very
champagne.
Very expensive champagne. Yeah, champagne I never heard of. I thought Veuve Clicquot was a high-end champagne.
It is.
These are champagnes that are like, you know, I don't know, a couple hundred dollars a bottle. I have no idea. Let's go to Bob in Pembroke. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, good morning. I think our president is incapacitated by many things, but not the least of which is narcissism, and I think that's going on here. I also think it's affecting many of us in the country, and I just want to leave you the quote from Mother Teresa.
Oh,
quote,
good.
We've just forgotten that we belong to each other.
That's pretty good.
Oh, Bob, that was really good.
Well, that is really good.
When you heard the president say he thought that most of the people that were affected by not having their pay during this time agree with him that it's more important to have the border wall.
You heard from one, by the way, so far?
That's true. I mean, you're worried about your rent, you're worried about your mortgage, you're worried about your kids' daycare.
Who is the most loyal person I have on Greater Boston to Donald Trump?
Joe Malone.
I asked Joe Malone, former treasurer of Massachusetts, last night, if he knew one federal worker who was in that group, who, even though they were not getting paid, was thrilled by the fact that Donald Trump was fighting for that wall, and he couldn't. He laughed and he said he couldn't identify.
Don't tell me Joe Malone.
No,
was
he didn't.
Defending.
No, no, no.
He
was
wall.
Not.
Was
no, actually, Malone
wall?
was much more middle of the road on this thing than he has been all trumped up to date, but he was much more middle of the road. We're going to spend a huge amount of today, by the way, talking about this with Carol Rose and the Civil Liberties Union at noon, to John King and also Corby Comer. We're going to talk about the food stamp threat that is right around the corner because of the shutdown, which could affect millions and millions of your neighbors and possibly you.
But up next, we're going to take a break. We're going to talk about sports with our sports authority, Trenny Kuznarek. She's here to go over the latest headlines. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and we are at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brody. She's Marjorie Egan. The NFL's so-called Black Monday resulted in a whiter Tuesday. Of the eight NFL coaches who were fired, five of them were black, leaving only two black coaches in a league where at least 70% of the players are African-American. Joining us for a take on this, the challenges ahead for the Patriots as they take on the Chargers and other sports headlines is Trenny Kuznarek. Trenny's an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a BPR contributor. Nice to see you, Trenny.
Happy New Year, guys.
And to you, of course.
Well, to show you how up I am on the whole NFL situation, when I was reading about the L.A. Chargers being a tough team for the Patriots to go against, I thought, what happened to the L.A. Rams? I thought it was the L.A. Rams, and I realized...
Well, at least you know that the L.A. Rams exist.
Yeah,
that
San
is good.
Diego. San
That's
Diego Chargers and now the L.A. Chargers.
But we have a jar at work this week, and every time you say San Diego Chargers, you have to put a dollar in it.
Ooh.
I actually have to retroactively put one in because this morning when I went to search for things that we can talk about on the show tonight, I immediately went to the San Diego Union Tribune.
Well, just as a quick aside, San Diego is like paradise on earth. Why would you move from San Diego to Los Angeles?
Because when you live in paradise on earth, you don't really go to a lot of football games. No one's going to their games in L.A. either, so it doesn't
really?
Matter. So the only game that they've lost on the road, and for those of you who are listening on the radio, you can't see my air quotations, was against the Rams in basically their home stadium. Every other time the Chargers have played away from Los Angeles, they have won their away games because no one goes to their home games.
Why?
Because I just think that it's a... I don't know. I guess they'd rather be surfing or doing yoga.
But is that
or...
different? I mean, to get people go to games in Green Bay, your
oh,
hometown?
Yes. Oh, my God. You can't...
Go to games in Green Bay?
I mean,
what else
been
do
selling
they do
out,
in Green
they,
Bay?
Yeah, they've been selling out games in Green Bay for as long as I
so
can remember, even when they're bad.
Too many other options.
There's that. I just don't think that people who live in that area are... A lot of them are transplants. So, like, if you grew up in Wisconsin or you grew up in New England, you are born with a Patriots playbook in one hand and a Red Sox cap in the other, right?
Yeah.
Like, you love sports. But in San Diego, it's like, okay, a lot of military people, so you're there from all over. So you might go to the game, but maybe you're cheering for whatever away team is there. That's the problem with places like L.A., San Diego, Atlanta, Phoenix. A lot of those places, their fan bases aren't great.
Maybe they're just out protesting government shutdowns.
Yes.
Is that possible?
Yeah, why can't we be more like France?
You know, before
exactly.
we talk about
We're
very
just talking
briefly.
About that. We're so passive.
About whether our 40-year-old quarterback is up for the challenge
41.
Against the chart, whatever he is, 41.
Is he 41 now?
I got an email this morning saying Philip Rivers, who's the quarterback for, as Marjorie knows, of course, for the Chargers.
Yes, absolutely.
Has 12 children. Is that true?
12?
Is it 12? I thought it was like 8 or 9. He has
but
a
he
million.
Does
he has a million of them, though, yes.
Wow. That
In
is
fact,
amazing.
In fact, he goes. He didn't want to, I mean, I can only imagine what it's like to relocate, a litter of children.
A litter.
So he doesn't, him and his wife and their children don't, they never relocated from San Diego when they moved. So Philip Rivers commutes from L.A. to San Diego every single day.
So his kids can stay in the schools?
So his kids can stay in school and so that he can go home and back and forth.
Is this a religious thing? Is he opposed to birth control?
I don't know,
She hasn't
Marjorie.
Talked to him about it recently.
Yeah, I'll ask him on the conference
call.
I
think
but whether it's 9 or 12
Have you ever
12
heard
or...
of a birth control pill, Philip Rivers?
Exactly.
So do you want to give us like a 30-second analysis of this Sunday game here?
I've picked the Chargers to win, and I'm sticking with it. I don't think that they probably actually won't, especially now that I know it's going to snow. I feel like,
oh,
but
good.
I do feel as though people are, and I'm sort of doing it out of spite because I think everyone is overlooking the Chargers and saying, oh, well, they're 0-8. I think Philip Rivers is 0-7 or 0-8 against Tom Brady. They're 0-8 at Foxborough. Their one win against the Patriots came in 2008, the year that Matt Castle was the quarterback, not Tom Brady. But this is a different Chargers team. I mean, Philip Rivers has a lot to play for. He's never been to a Super Bowl, and he's in that next tier of quarterbacks, and he's often got overlooked because he played in San Diego, plays for the Chargers, and they never made it to the big game. But they are a good team. They're a good offensive team. They have three really good wide receivers. They have Antonio Gates, a tight end, who's old. He's 37, so he's not exactly as quick as he used to be, but he's still a really effective player. Melvin Gordon, their running back, is a little banged up, but they have another running back, so they have a two-pronged running attack. And their defense is the kind of defense that can give Tom Brady fits. So the one thing the Patriots have, and I didn't know this until yesterday, so hat tip to Jeff Capitasto, our producer. But they're not very good. The Chargers defense isn't very good at defending pass-catching running backs, which is something the Patriots do really well.
So what do you think of the backup running back for the Chargers, Marjorie? What have you,
Austin
have you
Eckler?
Broken
you
that
like
down?
Austin Eckler? He had a great game.
He's stupendous.
What do you like most about? What do you like most about? Really cute? Is
really cute. I have no idea. Here's what I want to know. How cold is it supposed to be?
It's not supposed to be super cold, but I guess it's supposed to snow like 3 to 5 inches or something.
You do think if you live in L.A. or San Diego – and you're used to that beautiful weather, it must really be awful to be out there in 30 degrees.
I mean, it's awful for us, and we live in it. And we, you know, I'm like dressed, you know, like a Nordic woman every day in the winter. Also, keep in mind, they had to go to the East Coast to play the Ravens. They flew back to the West Coast, and now they're going to fly back to the East Coast.
Jet lag.
And the team actually wanted to stay on the East Coast, but it's so logistically challenging when you don't know. There was one of three teams they could have played. Tommy Curran, my colleague at NBC Sports Boston, actually sort of broke it down why they didn't stay on the East Coast, and it makes sense that why they went back.
Why didn't they stay?
Because logistically, it's a nightmare.
Couldn't get room for the 12 kids for Philip Rivers.
Couldn't get room for the 12 kids for the Rivers family. But also, not only would you have to book hotel rooms for staffs of upward of 103 cities, you also need security, you also need video, you also need practice facilities. Like people, there's a lot more that go into it that, quite frankly, I didn't even think about. That Tom aptly points out as important.
We're talking to Trenny Kuznarek. So, Trenny, I introduced this segment by using the term Black Monday. And for those who don't know about it has nothing to do. It preceded the fact that 5 black head coaches were fired. Black Monday is the day after the final Sunday of the regular season, which is usually firing day for coaches who didn't have a great year. There's been a lot of criticism of the league for they have this so-called Rooney Rule, where you have to interview a person of color for a head coach opening. But a lot of people think it's an empty thing because they fired 5 of the 7 black head coaches. Where are you on this thing?
So I don't think that they fired any of the coaches because of their race. I don't think race played a factor. I think that once you are given an opportunity in the NFL, it is equal opportunity. I mean, you know, I am a Green Bay Packer fan, and they fired Mike McCarthy, white Mike McCarthy, in the middle of the season because they were like, enough is enough. Aaron Rodgers hates you. We're moving forward. So I don't think the firing reflects, hey, we don't want, you know, African-American or, you know, Ron Rivera is Hispanic. He's the head coach of the Carolina Panthers. I don't think it's a minority thing in terms of when you get fired. Where I think the problem lies is in the cultivating, recruiting, and then hiring of African-American and minority head coaches. There were 7 of the 32 teams that were African-American or, in Ron's case, Hispanic. And now there are only 2. But the problem is, especially African-American men are pigeonholed into being defensive coaches. There are a lot of linebackers coaches and defensive lines and defensive backs and defensive coordinators. Very rarely do those positions translate into head coaches. Usually for a head coach for a football team, you want an offensive mind. And offensive coordinators, quarterbacks are primarily white.
Yeah.
And so that ends up being the people who rise through the ranks and get the head coaching opportunities. And I do feel like the Rooney Rule, while it has helped some, because
they tell people that don't know what
you
that
know,
is.
So the Rooney Rule was implicated years ago in order to at least give African-American head coaches, minority head coaches, a chance. So each team, while you're interviewing head coaches, you have to interview at least one minority candidate. But you just have to interview them. And oftentimes they're interviewed just to be a placeholder, knowing that you're going to end up hiring the white offensive coordinator anyway.
And I would suspect, too, well, I don't actually know how many college coaches end up being NFL coaches. But if so, I would assume the same system is pretty much true in college.
Yes, it's, again, predominantly on the defensive side. You have a lot of African-American head coaches on the offensive or on the coordinators and on the offensive side.
You know
side,
what one of these
white.
Stories said? And I can't be the only person that's not a sports expert that didn't know this. They talked about how Jackie Robinson, the great baseball player, of course, came in when there was, like, nobody that was black playing baseball, never got a job. He wanted a job in management. He never got one.
I actually didn't know that until I read Dave Zirin, who writes for the
Sports Racism. It doesn't say what it is.
I forget what the name
but
is.
Does,
the Nation. He writes for The Nation.
He
the
does
Nation.
Think racism
he
is
does
part
think
of
racism,
this firing thing.
Yeah,
he Sports Editor of The Nation.
He thinks it plays a larger part I respectfully disagree. Again, I don't think that the ownership looks and says, Todd Bowles of the New York Jets, you're black. That's why we're not winning. I think they look and say, you had some success. You haven't been able to sustain that success. Let's move forward. Because you also look at, you know, I would counter the point of being Marvin Lewis and Mike Tomlin, two African-American men. You know, yes, Mike Tomlin won a Super Bowl with the Steelers, but the Steelers have had far less success than their talent indicates they should have. He still has a job in Pittsburgh. Marvin Lewis was the head coach in Cincinnati for 16 years. They never went to a Super Bowl. I've been calling for that guy to be fired for forever. He's a terrible head coach.
You know,
so I think that it's a slippery slope to always assume that because someone loses a job, it's because of race. However, I do agree with him that people aren't getting jobs and don't have the opportunities because of race.
I want to stay on the race issue for a minute because this Black Monday thing happened after LeBron James made this comment on an episode of something called The Shop about NFL owners. Here's James.
They got a bunch of old white men owning teams, and they got that slave mentality. And it's like, this is my team. You do what the I tell y'all to do, or we get rid of y'all.
Is that a Colin Kaepernick thing? What was that all about?
No, I mean, I think he makes, I mean, listen, using the slave reference is obviously very loaded. These guys they're getting paid, right? I mean, they're getting paid good money to play football. However, we've talked about this on this show before, the money you make in the NFL is vastly different than the money you can make in Major League Baseball, the NBA, or even the NHL to a certain point. So in the NBA,
Their careers are shorter,
and the NFL is 70% African American. Yet again, a small percentage of head coaches are minority, and I don't believe there are any minority owners. The Jacksonville Jaguars have a minority owner, but that's it. I don't think he's entirely wrong. I mean, you think about it. It's the NFL that's constantly clamping down on free speech. It's the NFL that donated, I think that article by Dave Zirin quoted $8 million
to the Trump
inauguration fund. This is a league that kowtowed to President Trump when he again used black players and the kneeling and the anthem protests as a way to rally his base and call them SOBs and tries to, you know, call them un-American for, quite frankly, exercising their right of free speech and protest. So, you know, while the language is strong, I don't think LeBron James is all that off base. I am always shocked that more NFL players don't speak out, but how could you speak out? Because once you speak out on something, you're blackballed. Eric Reed, who does play for a team, was the other player to kneel with Colin Kaepernick in San Francisco. He has been drug tested numerous times this season, and many people think it's because the NFL is trying to punish him and single him out for being someone who sides with Colin Kaepernick.
We're talking to Trenny because now, Trenny, can we switch sports and go to New York City to the Knicks, which have had the worst team for decades. There's a player who will not go to London with the team for a game. What's the backstory?
So this is actually a really interesting story. The guy's name is Enes Kanter. He is a Turkish basketball player who now lives in the United States. And this really all started over the summer. He was trying to travel back through, and I'm now forgetting the country he was trying to travel back from.
Romania.
It was Romania. I thought that, and I was like, why would a guy be in Romania? Anyway, he was in Romania and was not allowed to leave. His visa and his passport, his Turkish passport, were confiscated by Turkish officials because he has been extremely vocal about what he feels are dictator-like actions of Erdogan, who is the president of Turkey. He continues to be very vocal about it, about the human rights violations there, about the way the free press, the so-called free press, is treated there. So now he was supposed to travel to London. The Knicks are playing the Washington Wizards in London, but he has chosen not to go because he is afraid for his life. He's afraid he'll be killed if he goes there. because he said there are a number of Turkish operatives that live in London, and he thinks that there's a chance he could be assassinated. Now, the Knicks, I don't know why they did this, but they came out afterwards and said, no, 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 this is a visa problem. That's why he's not going. It's a visa problem. And Cantor, to his credit, said, absolutely not, NBA. Absolutely not, Knicks. You're not going to throw me under the bus like this. Here is my U.S. passport. He now has a U.S. passport. There's no reason. It's not a document issue. I'm not going by my own personal choice because I don't feel safe going there.
You know what's so interesting about the NBA interceding and coming up with a false a reason for a politically charged thing? We're just talking about LeBron James.
Right. I listened to that
whole interview.
It's usually a pretty progressive.
In that same interview where he's describing the owners of as old white men with a slave mentality in the NFL, he goes out of his way to say Adam Silver is the
yes.
commissioner of the NBA.
Yeah.
What an enlightened, progressive guy he is. This is LeBron James speaking, who allows players to speak their mind, engage in whatever political protest. But here, for whatever political reason, they were deciding they were trying to change the story with this Cantor
yeah,
guy,
and,
no?
And that might be, I don't think that's an Adam Silver thing. I think that's a Knicks thing. I don't know enough about, I do know that the Knicks ownership has been under some scrutiny for a while. I mean, you had the whole Isaiah Thomas sexual harassment thing, right. along with the New York Liberty, which is their WNBA team. I believe it's the Dolans who own the Knicks and the Liberty. So it's a little different. The Knicks organization as a whole may not be quite as progressive and forward-thinking as Adam Silver and the rest of the league.
And look what they said in addition to holding him at the airport. They said that the state-run news agency in Turkey reported that prosecutors were seeking more than 4 years in jail for this basketball player on charges because all he did was insult Erdogan on social media.
Yeah.
I guess they don't fool around in Turkey. One false tweet and it's all over for you.
No, I mean they have, and it's sort of fallen under the radar. I feel like Turkey was really in the news. Now it's almost 2 years ago where there was the attempted coup on Erdogan. But since that happened, and I traveled to Turkey, it'll be, I think, two or
really?
3 years ago now in February.
It's beautiful.
It's
people.
Beautiful.
For
Istanbul,
fun?
Yeah, I went because I just always, you know, it's a country and a city that straddle the East and the West.
Yeah.
And I loved it. The food was incredible. The people were very kind. But it was a tense time to be there. I went in between one of the first. There was the attack at the Blue Mosque, I think that December, on some German tourists. And then maybe 2 weeks after we left, there was a bombing on Istiklal Street, which is like their main shopping thoroughfare. And then it wasn't much longer after that that there was the attack at the airport with the suicide bomber. So they went through a phase where I remember walking through the streets of Istanbul and having a water bottle I wanted to throw away into the trash and asking. We had been connected with a guy who lived there, was a tour guide and a friend of someone, and was just sort of showing us around. And I asked him, I said, why can't I throw my garbage away? And he said, there are no trash cans anymore because they're afraid that someone will come and bomb in them and then have them explode. So
but
it's sort of fallen off the radar of all of everything that's going on there. And again, not to get overly political, but the way I believe that the Trump administration has sort of propped up and dealt with Erdogan and what's going on in Turkey is, you know, just it doesn't rise to the level of what's going on with Russia and China. So I think it falls. I think it falls on a little unnoticed.
We're talking to Trini Kuznick. Can we talk about a good news story
for a second? This is
a great
story.
Talk about this 92-year-old woman.
I love
this.
Heather Lee is her name. Who is she?
Heather Lee is a race walker, which is a real thing. It's actually an Olympic sport, but she's 92 years old. And she started race walking in her early 80s.
When she was 85. Yeah.
Okay, mid-80s, okay. 85. I thought it was 83.
Exactly.
85. And her second husband, when he was dying, said, now is your time to shine. Like, you know, don't waste any more time. And so she just started walking and realized that she was good at it. And now she holds world records for her age group in age 90 to 94. But she gets up every single day. She walks, like, last year she walked like 3 million steps. Every day she's walking more than 10,000 steps. And the woman who wrote this story, it's Barry Weiss,
Barry
right?
Barry Weiss, yeah, from the New York Times.
Yeah, she's great. She's a great columnist. She said she had a hard time keeping up with this woman.
That's great.
I love it because I was home over the holidays and I visited with my grandfather who's 92 and my grandmother who's 86. And I'm lucky to still have two living grandparents who, for all intents and purposes, are still relatively healthy. Both have fallen and broken their hips. But, like, neither of them are getting up every morning and walking 10,000 steps. And it's to me, it's just sort of this woman's attitude of, you know what, it doesn't matter that I'm getting old. I still have my faculties about me. I'll live as long as I possibly can, and this makes me feel good. And it, people should know that if you get out and you exercise and you get fresh air, that has made all the difference.
You know what I love about this story that Barry Weiss wrote about this, Heather Lee? One little line, I don't know why it got me, is while she's praising her deceased second husband for giving her the incentive and whatever, when she's asked by Barry Weiss about her first husband, she said she doesn't want to talk about him, which I thought that was great.
Yeah, she really was like, that first husband, because she actually moved with her daughter away from England to Australia to like get away from the guy.
That was pretty
good.
But
listen how she describes the marriage to her second husband. She says they had a wonderful, 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 perfect life living by the sea with 2 or 3 mango trees and 23 pawpaw trees. I don't even know what those are.
I mean, I didn't either.
And they would barter their fruit for fresh fruit fish caught by their friends for fun.
It's fabulous.
What a way to live.
Very nice.
Also,
huh?
Get out there and exercise.
That's right.
Hey, before you leave, Marjorie and I were talking about this morning, this mixed doubles match. Marjorie was totally unimpressed by it.
Because it was girl-boy.
So what? That's called mixed doubles.
I know. But
arguably the greatest male tennis player of all time, Roger Federer, and clearly the greatest woman player of all time,
Serena
Williams.
Well, that would have been different if it had been one against
the
other.
Like Bobby Riggs.
Exactly.
They're not doing that kind of thing. In a mixed doubles thing, the two of them go. I just love that story. Arguably for the final, obviously the final time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm sort of with Marjorie. Like, I think it's cool. Mixed doubles has been around for a while. I think it's cool that they faced off against one another.
Yeah.
Federer's team, by the way, that they won.
They won.
But I think some people are searching, and not you, Jim.
I am searching.
But I feel like there are some people who are looking at that and trying to see, like, you know, maybe there is a Federer-Serena match, and we can finally see once and for all who's the greatest tennis player. I think that's a trap that a lot of feminists fall into, or people who want to prop up women's sports. We're not the same. We don't operate the same. We don't have the same strength and agility. We're different. Men and women are genetically different human beings. What I think we should be doing with women's sports is saying, just because it's different doesn't mean it's worse. And that's the trap I think we fall into every time we see these stories about, look at Serena and Federer, two of the best going after each other. Which is better than the other? Well, you know, Federer probably 9 times out of 10 is going to beat Serena because he's stronger and more powerful than she is, even though she's the most powerful woman's tennis player in terms of serving and returns and volleys and things like that. But I think that's a trap we've fallen into for a really long time. Like, we're always trying to say, like, look, we're just like, no, women are, we're different, but that doesn't
even
mean we're worse.
There are a lot of people who think long distance running may be the sport.
It might be the women, really long distance running. Yeah. I'll tell you guys when I run. By the way, how about our guy Colin O'Brady? We haven't.
Oh,
he,
yes,
he finished.
Indeed.
Oh, that was a great story.
We
did. Yeah,
Kane,
we were so happy about that.
He finished.
He did great. They
and the
both
other guy
finished
too.
Yeah,
the
two
guy,
days later.
So after no one had ever done it, two men finished within a couple of days from each other. But the USA, we won.
Yeah, and
we
I can't believe
Antarctica,
the guy
that we're talking about.
Yes,
for those who missed this.
Yep.
Yes, in Antarctica. And the guy, Colin O'Brady, is it?
Yep.
He did 30 hours.
32 hours, 80 miles, his last
can
day,
you
so
imagine?
That he could just finish.
Oh,
I'm obsessed with the guy now. Chelsea's obsessed with him, too.
How could you not be obsessed with him?
I know.
We're done, Marjorie.
All right, we are
done.
Thanks,
guys.
Nice to see you, Trenny.
I can't get enough Colin O'Brady talk. Trenny Kuznarek joins us every week. She's anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston, and she's a Boston Public Radio contributor. Up next, ICE detainees are continually being denied justice and due process. The ACLU's Carol Rose joins us to talk about that, the government shutdown, and more. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
At noon on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, is it legal for Trump to declare a national emergency to fund his wall? We'll ask the ACLU's Cal Rose about this, and if it's illegal to demand that federal employees work without pay. And then instead of farm to table, how about freeway to table? Oregon just became the latest state to let people eat roadkill for dinner. Massachusetts does too, by the way. We'll talk to food writer Corby Cummer about this. Then we open the lines and ask you if eating roadkill is the best way for us carnivores to maintain a humane and sustainable diet.
Delicious. Tonight, President Donald Trump will make his case for border wall funding in a primetime Oval Office address, only to be topped by his visit to the southern border. We'll ask CNN's John King if this will be a winning strategy for Trump or fodder for Democrats. Then Harvard historian Nancy Kane puts this shutdown in an historical context. All that is next on 89.7 WGVH, Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again. And by the way, I raised the notion of the question about whether or not we would be broadcasting the speech live tonight. We obviously are. And we will be broadcasting the Democratic rebuttal. You know, I'm wondering, when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker the first time, did we ever have the Democratic leader of the Senate and the Democratic leader of the House of Representatives jointly do a response to anything? And, well, of course, I guess there was a Democratic president.
I don't know.
And that may have been part of it.
I don't know.
And but this is pretty unusual.
Yeah, usually, they picked Joe Kennedy the last time. He was broadcasting from Fall River.
That was for the State of the Union,
Yeah, they usually pick some kind of they don't usually have the
Speaker of the House.
Well, I think
the difference, I'm guessing, it's because they're involved in the negotiations, obviously, or the so-called negotiations. So that may be
Jim, that's a brilliant insight.
Thank you. I thought it was really insightful. Thank you very much. Joining us to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of civil liberties and government agencies is Carol Rose. Carol, as you know, is the executive director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Carol, Happy New Year. Nice to see you.
Happy New Year. Great to be here.
Well, Carol Rose, let's start with what's going on tonight with the president giving a speech and supposedly going to try to declare a national emergency to get the border wall. Yeah. What are the you're from the ACLU. Can he declare a national emergency? I mean, what's the deal?
Well, I mean, he can try, but he's going to be challenged in court, whether by the ACLU or about a million other groups that are going to line up to try to do it. Because, I mean, first of all, there is no national emergency except the one that the Trump administration itself has created by separating children and families at the border and by, you know, trying to having these children who are dying in immigration custody along the border, separating children from their mothers and fathers. This kind of stuff that's going on, that's the real emergency.
I didn't think we were still separating children from their mothers and fathers.
Oh, yeah, they still haven't reunited the thousands of people who were there, and then they're leaving. Through different circumstances, there are still people being, children and parents being separated, but they also haven't reunited the ones that their original policy had being separated. But in any event, Trump's trying to use his executive branch power to declare a national emergency, although we don't know what that emergency is. There's no military threat as such to the country. As a way to commandeer both money and soldiers and military people to go and try to do his bidding by building the border wall. And I think this is clearly going to be declared unconstitutional because we cannot commandeer our military to do domestic work.
So how does this work, though? If he declares a national emergency, then he gets a bunch of people go to court and try to stop him. In the interim, can he begin building the wall, or is it...
Right, so that'll be up to the court. So what the lawyers for the civil rights groups will try to do is to get a preliminary injunction or an injunction to prevent it from going forward in the meantime. And since the status quo is, you know, there is no emergency, I think the courts are pretty likely to, you know, at a minimum, pause it, put a halt to it, an injunction on it, until such time as they can address the merits. But I think they're going to lose on the merits as well. And the real danger here, and Bruce Ackerman from Yale Law School has done a wonderful analysis of this in the New York Times, basically saying that not only would it be illegal for President Trump to declare this, it would actually be illegal for the soldiers and the military officers to comply with that. So it's creating a real danger for our people in the service, and that's really unfortunate.
Beyond the people in the service, I hate to use terms that are incendiary where they're not appropriate, but there is potential for there to be a constitutional crisis over this. I mean, if the president declares a national emergency in a situation where I think most objective observers believe there isn't one,
that's
and
correct.
Believes he can take unilateral action,
that's right.
Whether one is in favor of the wall or against the wall,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me it's a pretty, another term I can't stand, slippery slope, where he can declare national emergencies in other situations.
Whenever he doesn't get his
and take other, exactly, take other unilateral. And I would right. hope that whether you're a Trump supporter out there or a Trump detractor, you'd be concerned about the unilateral exercise of power by any president of the United States that
yeah.
clearly appears to exceed his authority in this
right.
case.
Right, and this has happened. I mean, this happened, you know, in Watergate, right? There's been times where presidents have tried to invoke emergency powers. The holding Japanese Americans.
Internment, yeah.
Thank you, of Japanese Americans. FDR did that through a national emergency. But that was a time of war. And since then, the Supreme Court has declared that it was a mistake. So, I mean, we've learned these lessons time and time again. But the notion of trying to do it for a domestic policy is really something different and new, and I think really dangerous, as you say, Jim. And I can't imagine the courts would allow, even the Trump controlled courts, as they're becoming increasingly. I can't imagine any court would allow a president to get away with this, and I think it's a dangerous omen if they do.
We're talking to Carol Rose, the head of the Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts. Can we talk about another thing that relates to this insane shutdown? Mm. The two unions that represent a significant chunk of the 800,000 employees, the American Federation of Government Employees, and I think the National Treasurer Workers Union, I believe Treasury Workers Union, but whoever it is, have sued Trump, basically arguing that not the furloughed half, but those who were required to work, the other half, that forced work service violates the Fair Labor Standards Act. What's the argument and how likely is it to prevail?
I mean, the argument is you cannot be forced to work without being paid. I mean, these are people, they still have to pay their bills, they have to pay their mortgages, they have to pay for their heating and their electricity and their food. They don't get a moratorium on the expenses that they have going out, and they face real dangers. And beyond that, being forced then to work without pay anyway is clearly, I think, a violation of the National Labor Standards Act. Fair Labor Standards Act. So I can
that
see
that requires you be paid at least the minimum wage for the work
for
that
the work
you do.
That you do.
You
right.
know, I have to say, can I? This is one of these things where I was going to say I'm sort of a lawyer, which I sort of am. But let me do what non-lawyers often say in these circumstances. How could this possibly be legal? And, you know, forget the Fair Labor Standards Act. The notion that unless there's an explicit federal law, and if there is, I assume you'll tell me about it, an explicit federal law that exempts federal employees from this, this is like involuntary servitude. I mean, it right. basically...
Well, also, because if you're not getting paid and you're worried about paying your bills, what you do right. is you try to go out and get another
a
job.
A different job.
And you can't really go out and get another job
exactly.
if you're one of these poor prison people that we talked about before down in mm-hmm. the panhandle of
or
Florida.
Being forced to work.
Being forced to work and have to drive 400 miles to get to work and not even going to get reimbursed for that. Right. Or if you're these IRS people that could probably get other jobs easily because they're accountants and they're right. a number of people, but they can't because he's saying they have to go to work.
Anyway.
Anyway.
And I think that puts them in a different situation than, say, the furloughed employees who can go out and, you know, get a job at,
they
at
can.
You know, a seasonal job.
Or can
or
at least try to get
or,
a job.
Or try to. Right, exactly. But for the people who are both forced to work and then not paid, that is clearly a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act and probably of some other, you know, is it slavery-ish kinds of laws.
But hasn't there been such a law? I'm assuming the reason why I'm somewhat dubious about this, even though I hope they succeed, is I'm assuming the unions who represent federal employees have threatened to or have actually sued during prior shutdowns.
Yeah,
what's
but I
happened
think prior
there?
Shutdowns have been so short, Jim. I mean, I don't think we're going on a
third
week.
Well, it was the 21-day one. Was that under Bill Clinton, the 21-day one? Whatever it was. The
I don't know. But you do think, too, why we talked before about why Americans aren't up in arms. Why aren't the heads of all these unions getting
well, they
together?
Actually, they've been the yelling.
They now
have
they
been.
Are.
In fact,
but
on
I mean,
CNN
doing
on
kind
John
of a mass, you don't have to go to work. You know, unless you're afraid it's going to be like Reagan Redux, where he's going to fire all the TSA
right.
agents
Remember
or the
that?
Air
right.
traffic
PACO,
controllers.
The air traffic controllers. So.
Right.
I mean, but they could do that. I'm wondering if they could do that now, because Reagan did it then. Remember when they went on strike?
Sure.
So
they got away with it, by the way.
He did get away with it, and it changed a lot of...
But you know what there was in response to it? Because I was there. There were national demonstrations, unlike now, in Washington shortly after he fired the PATCO workers, the air traffic control workers. The public, even though we lost that fight, did respond, unlike now, where we respond with tweets and lawsuits as opposed to demonstrations.
That's the danger of the Internet is people think that they can just tweet and it'll solve it.
But let me ask you guys, because you're both lawyers.
Well, I'm not really.
If the heads of the unions for the TSA and the air traffic controllers and the border agents and the prison, federal prison guard, if they all got together and said, we're not going to work, we're not getting paid,
I mean, just go on strike.
Isn't that,
I mean, that
a strategy?
That would be the other option. But I think that these are people who, I mean, they are very dedicated people. They care about public safety. These are people who are, you know, out there making sure that the American people are safe when we fly or travel or the other things. And so I think for them, it puts them into a really difficult position.
Also,
if they go on strike, then they may lose their, you know,
well,
ultimately there could be a lockout and other
or
things.
Or they get fired like the
right,
the
well,
traffic
beyond
controllers
that,
yeah,
did.
Okay.
Can one of our producers back home in Brighton check? Because I'm guessing that some of these federal workers are also statutorily prohibited.
Well, that's
from
why
right.
the air traffic yeah. controllers were yeah. fired, because they were supposedly
sort of
not
essential
able
employee
to strike.
Yeah.
Essential employees, yeah. But right. it seems like they could do something.
Well, I think what they're doing, and they're doing the right thing, which is instead of going on strike right now, they're deciding to go and file a claim with the National Labor Standards Act,
yeah.
With the National Labor Relations Board. And that is, you know, the mechanism that's set up. So in contrast to President Trump, these are people who are actually playing by the rules.
Can I make another suggestion?
What?
They could all do what that 170 TSA workers did at either LaGuardia
call
or JFK. Let every federal employee call in sick.
At the same time.
For a day.
A flu epidemic.
A blue flu kind of thing.
Through federal agencies.
And good Lord, it could come true, because, you know, at that point, if we don't have people who are providing public health services, we don't know what kinds of dangers we're facing.
And not to mention the overflowing trash cans
the
and
trash,
rats.
I mean, right. I mean, the people need to, I think people, the American people understand, if President Trump doesn't, that the government provides key services, whether it's collecting our garbage, keeping our food and water safe, providing public health and safety, you know, all these kinds of services that we assume are there. We just take them for granted. But President Trump, I don't think, because he isn't personally affected, he doesn't seem to have any sympathy for the fact that there are a lot of people suffering, both workers and
well, you didn't hear him say, he said the press thing availability, he can relate to the plight of these these workers who are going without pay. You know, for whatever it's worth, just as an aside for a second, can you imagine, for anybody listening to this show, I don't care what you do for a living. Some people do essential work. I would like to think we do, but we don't.
We do not, Jim.
Can you imagine if tomorrow our boss said to us, we're going to stop paying you. We're not going to tell you when we're going to pay you next.
Yeah, you have a nervous breakdown.
And in fact, wait, even worse. We may not pay you for years, as the President of the United States said. Oh, but one thing I forgot to tell you, you got to come to work every single
yeah.
day, because I consider you an essential employee.
Plus,
it is amazing.
And think of people with not just mortgages, but people with the student loan debt,
right.
the car payments,
read
all
what
those
our
things.
Producers just typed
and
on our screen, please.
And I just want to say, Jim and Marge,
before
we'd
you
miss
do that,
you.
Our producer says, thank you. We're not working for free. That's for damn sure. sign the producers of Boston.
Oh, my gosh.
Public
we'd have to do it alone, Jim. So
we're talking
to Carol Rose from the ACLU. So this whole government shutdown is about a quote-unquote national emergency at the border in the South. You have some immigration stories that are pretty horrifying. Tell us about this gentleman, Ramirez.
Julio Ramirez.
Yes.
Yeah, so the ACLU here in Massachusetts and across the country has been doing a huge amount of litigation and work on behalf of immigrants and their families, many of whom are U.S. citizens, and so not all of them are undocumented. This is a situation for a man here in Massachusetts, Julio Ramirez. He came here 14 years ago from Guatemala, and he built a life. You know, I mean, he had volunteered for community organizations, had his own construction company. He bonded with his sisters and his nieces, so he was really building a life here. He was in a minor traffic accident, which he said he was not at fault and was ultimately found not to be at fault. But he said, you know, we need to call the police and make sure we file a report. Well, what happens is instead he ended up going to court, and at court, ICE showed up and detained him in the parking lot outside of the courthouse. Now, this is happening with increasing frequency, and it's really concerning, because we want people to be able to access justice, to go to the courts, whether they're going there as defendants or as witnesses or as people who have complaints. We want people to be able to access our courts. And so the fact that the Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE service, has been arresting people and detaining them is bad enough. But to make matters worse, then, they locked him up in an ICE detention facility, and they wouldn't let him go back to court to actually have his day in court, which means he would have been facing an outstanding warrant, and that's a deportable offense. So it's a catch-22 for these immigrants. If you can't,
that is unbelievable.
If you might have a minor, you know, fender bender kind of thing like Mr. Ramirez did, and if you can't go to court, you become deportable simply because you didn't show up in court. So what the ACLU has been arguing, and this is now the second case that we've won, is that people like Mr. Ramirez have a right to access justice, that ICE or the jail, somebody has to get him to his court hearing. And when we filed suit They did take him to his court hearing. All the charges against him were dismissed, in fact, and he was set free. But it took us 3 months to do that.
3 months he was in prison?
3 months he was in prison.
What happened to his business?
That's a great question. You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to it, but it's dangerous.
How do you hook up with these people?
So, I mean, the ACLU lawyers, we have huge relationships. The whole movement of with the immigration bar, immigration lawyers, criminal defense bar, and things like that. So we have relationships with them, and they know the ACLU is both nonpartisan and that we do structural law reform, right? We just don't take individual cases. We're trying to fix the system so we don't just have a lot of individual cases, but impact litigation. So the situation for Mr. Ramirez is we've been trying to now change the practice by ICE, which is to say, ICE, if you're going to detain them, you have to take them to their court hearings. And now it looks like we're moving in that direction. It took two lawsuits, but I think we're finally having that situation resolved. But I just heard yesterday from other states, other ACLUs in other states, that this is now happening in other states. So they're now looking to Massachusetts.
So let's just be straight on this, though.
Can I just update on people before this gets old? Because we asked about these federal employees. One of our coworkers has gotten us this input. Congress has repeatedly and emphatically forbidden federal employees from striking. No person or group is allowed to hold essential what are considered essential government services. And as you mentioned, in 1981, when PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, went on strike under Robert Polo, I was the president then. He said the skies will be silent. And obviously that was a violation of this mandate, and Reagan fired them, and that almost immediately after having taken office. I'm sorry.
But I just want to make sure I have this straight. So this guy is picked up in court by ICE.
Right, in then the parking lot outside of the courthouse.
Then he has a court date, and they intentionally keep him in detention.
Correct.
So he misses the court date, so he would have a deportable offense.
That's correct. It's a real catch-22.
That is like creating crime.
Yes, that doesn't exist. That's
but
exactly
wait a second.
Right,
but is there when you said before in the context of something else we were talking, even Trump imported judges, is there a judge who anywhere in this country, I probably shouldn't be asking this question, but I guess it's too late now, who would say, that's called bootstrapping. Is it not? Essentially, ICE created the condition, as Marjorie and you described, that makes him deportable,
right,
where he wanted to appear and comply with law. Is there anybody who'd deport that guy for just the warrant alone, not the underlying offense, had there been one?
Yeah, I mean, so
the warrant alone, even when ICE is the reason why the warrant would have been issued to begin with?
That's why we filed the suit, because it's so outrageous. But it's also important for people to understand the criminal courts are a third branch of government from the executive and the legislative. But the immigration courts sit under the executive branch.
Oh, the executive branch.
So those immigration judges are actually immigration executive authority judges.
And they're
in a different
are they essential employees? But are they on furlough too? Are they not? Aren't the immigration judges on furlough?
They're judges unpaid that have been forced to create this assembly line at 90 miles per hour to get these cases through where they're totally overwhelmed too.
Right.
So it's very possible in a situation like that that you may not even have the time to understand the details of the case.
Right, and since you aren't provided with a lawyer necessarily, and you may not even speak the language, you don't know what's happening, right?
Yeah.
So part of it is, so we're really working on this access to justice notion of making sure that if somebody is picked up for a crime, you know, especially when they're minor offenses or not even offenses like this one, they have the opportunity to access the courts without facing immigration deportation.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm looking over your head to our buddy John King show, and he's going to be on with us at roughly 1:20. There's a TSA employee who's saying she's not going to be able to pay her mortgage when it's due. One of the things, this may be obvious, but I hadn't thought about this. Why hasn't this pathetic Congress, in bipartisan fashion, passed a law that I assume there'd be pressure on Trump to sign, that at minimum doesn't allow foreclosure during the pendency, private foreclosure,
I actually think
the pendency of this shutdown?
There are such proposals coming out of the House. Yeah, there are proposals, and that the Senate is refusing to take them up. There are proposals.
The Senate is refusing to take them up?
I mean, the Republicans are basically refusing to take it up. And the ACLU is nonpartisan, but there is, in fact, a partisan divide on how to respond to this, obviously.
So the Republican Senate thinks that these people should be...
free market. It's a free market solution to the problem, I guess.
When the government
actually
forces
horrible.
You to work without pay, there's a free market solution? I don't think so.
You know, one of the things, I was going to make a joke, which was really horrible, about the immigration courts and say, well, what they should just do is implement what Massachusetts has done with the secret courts. I've been reading all this stuff
about the
Boston
clerk magistrate.
You know, I have to say, I have been so incredulous, and my threshold for incredulity, if that's the right word, is pretty high. Mm-hmm. These are these courts. We've talked about this on the air, but I don't think with you. These courts that run often with non-lawyers, right, in secret. There's no public announcement. Right. The most egregious cases I could think of is, remember that judge, I think her name was Curtin, was on video stealing a $4,000 watch.
Yeah.
At Logan.
Her case was dismissed.
Jared Remy, 13 years before he killed his girlfriend, had a case of threatening another girlfriend, right, dismissed,
right,
by this. And most recently, and most incredibly, not most incredibly, read yesterday, and good for the Boston, it's all Boston Globe reporting, by the way.
Yeah.
I should have said this.
Todd
the only state that has this, has these kind of things. Most recently, we find out that Kevin Spacey, who is charged with a felony, his lawyers went before one of these secret courts in December in an attempt, unsuccessful, to get it dismissed. The good news was it wasn't dismissed. The bad news was the secret courts, as bad as they are only supposed to deal with misdemeanors.
Right.
His is a felony. The right. magistrate considered his case anyway.
We clearly,
are you guys going to get involved in this thing? Well, I mean, this is outrageous.
So, I mean, on the side of why we need, why the clerk magistrate system works, is it's a way to dispose of a lot of misdemeanor, low-level cases where we don't want to keep people out of the criminal
system. So let them be
system.
Public and, right. and let them be, there be public notice right. of these things. I mean,
but on the other
which
side,
is what Maura Healey said to us the other
right,
day.
And yeah. as what you're saying, which is so egregious, is that people, it seems to depend on who you know and how you're connected. And that really undermines faith in the criminal legal system, in the criminal justice system, that
well,
it doesn't have justice. Because if some people get more justice than others, that's not fair. And that's really bad for our court system.
Well, I would also argue, we discussed the Jared Remy thing a lot, and you actually got an incredible letter from Jared Remy, Marjorie from jail, attacking you during this yeah. whole thing after he murdered his girlfriend.
Luckily, he was in jail at that point.
I think you could make a credible case that it had that threat of to kill his girlfriend, and I think it was 2000, mm-hmm. not dismissed in secret. Maybe the mother of the kid would not be dead in whatever year it was,
right.
2013.
Right.
I mean, it's just this whole...
Well, he went through five girlfriends and in public cases
that's
as
why,
well.
That's why, you know, the statute of justice is blind because it's supposed to be equal for everyone.
But you know what's incredible?
To be fair.
You know what's incredible? And the judge is retired, if I'm not mistaken, the one that stole the Cartier watch.
She did.
But, I mean, think about
Patricia
that.
Patricia Curtin, I shouldn't say
that. You
her
could
name
have
until
a judge
out.
Stealing a watch.
Right.
Off the, you know, the gray containers that we all have to put our shoes in or our laptops in. I mean, that is so bizarre.
Well, you know, we at the ACLU did
Patricia
some
Curtin is her name, yeah.
We did some polling recently of as part of our What a Difference a DA Makes voter education campaign.
Yeah.
And one of the highest things we found was that 80-some percent of people in Massachusetts believe that the amount of justice you get depends on who you know. And that's just a shame because it shouldn't depend on who you know. It should be not or who you are. It should depend on your actions and your actions
yeah.
alone. And so I think the Globe bringing this out, creating transparency, putting sunlight on it, I think is the first step towards be able to have law reform to change it. And I do think transparency is the start.
Can I make a naive comment, though? It almost as naive as me saying a minute ago to you, why hasn't Congress in bipartisan fashion just passed a bill like this? Prohibiting any foreclosures during the pendency
or
of the
evictions.
Shutdown. I know the legislature of Beacon Hill just returned a couple of days ago.
Yep.
Why is there not maybe there is a bill. Why is there not a bill at minimum doing what you and the Attorney General say, right. saying there's got to be full transparency, got to be full notice,
right.
there's got to be a record kept. Who opposes this? Except whatever hacks
people
benefit
have had,
from the system.
People
exactly.
have had their cases fixed.
Exactly,
and
my point.
Who knows how many of them are that right. have had their cases right. fixed. I mean, that's what's really upsetting. It's also, of course, how good your legal talent is. You know, mm-hmm. I think when I had the trials I covered as a reporter that who your lawyer was made an enormous
Marjorie,
difference.
Marjorie, do you think former judge Patricia Curtin was let free because of her great legal talent after
no.
a video of her
no,
stealing a
$4,000
watch?
No, but I'm saying if you are a
watch,
guilty defendant and you have a very talented lawyer, you often are acquitted when you have not.
Excuse me. I would say in a secret court, who you know is more important
yes.
than the great skill you have as a lawyer.
No, I was reacting to Carol's point
oh.
that 80% of whatever it is, people think that justice
Believe
has
it
to do
depends
with
on who you know.
Who you know, and I would say it also depends on the quality of your
And
legal
by the way,
talent.
I want to end with just what you said a couple of seconds. Todd Wallach, and he does have some team members, and I'm sorry, I don't know who worked with him. If you haven't read this secret, if you want your blood pressure to explode, if it isn't already about this shutdown, read the Todd Wallach et al. Series about these secret courts. It really is excellent
and
reporting.
And to your point, we'll know by the end of the month what all the new bills are. There will be thousands of new
yeah,
bills in
true.
The legislature, and we'll have a really good sense and hopefully a good conversation about what lies ahead for civil rights and civil
liberties.
I hope
liberties. So. Enjoy the year.
Did you try to take care of that ticket with the state trooper, Jim? Did you go up to Beacon Hill?
Marjorie, what I did was I did what you're supposed to do. I demanded a trial. I had a trial, and you came as a hostile witness. Do you know she? I'm not going to do this story again. She had to be called as a hostile witness in my behalf, a hostile witness.
Because.
Okay, let's leave it.
He wanted me to lie.
No, I did. By the way, that is so. Totally
untrue. I'm incredulous.
I did not want you to lie. I wanted you to tell the truth.
And let me tell you, he was the great white defendant. He was about 15 shades lighter and about a foot and a half tall.
No, can I tell that part? I will tell in 30 seconds. Yeah. I go to the courtroom in Dorchester for this thing where Marjorie is forced to come as a witness for me. And my lawyer is the head of the former Mass Bar, a good friend of mine, Ed Ryan.
Yep.
And I walk in the courtroom, and there are, 500 defendants, 300?
A lot of defendants.
Everyone is a person of color, except for one. That would be me. And so I go over to Ed Ryan, and we're talking about the case. The judge is doing an arraignment at some hospital bed. Right. And he said, anything you want to tell me? I said, yeah, one thing. I do not want to be the first case called.
But
in a room
somehow,
with all people of color and me, I do not, because I was not first also on the the docket outside the courtroom. What was the first case called?
Is that
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Wow.
Whatever.
We've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
We have a new year to
do
it.
Go.
He had great legal talent.
I did have great legal talent.
And a good
Ed
witness.
Ryan.
Well, I was convicted on one of the two counts, by the way. To be perfectly honest. Thank you, exactly.
I cannot tell a lie.
Goodbye.
Carol Rose joins us every month. She's executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. Thank you very much, Carol Rose. Up next.
That was one of the worst experiences because of you, by the way. Because of you.
How New Year's
really
resolutions
funny.
Are creating crowd control problems and healthy eateries. This is a great story. Our food writer, Corby Comer, joins us to go over that and more next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Bradley and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The Department of Agriculture is among the 9 federal agencies, I'm sure you know, that shut down in December. If the shutdown continues to drag on, it could hit the nearly 40 million people in this country who are on food stamps particularly hard. While the president says he's fighting for border security, he could be exacerbating food insecurity. Joining us to talk about this and a whole host of other food policy and food culture issues is Corby Comer. Corby's a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and, of course, a BPR contributor. Hello there, Corby Comer.
Well, good afternoon.
Well, we got a lot of great stories today, Corby Comer, but we'll start with the really tough one about food stamps hanging in the balance. What's going on?
Well, food stamps, SNAP, are an entitlement program, which means it's mandatory. The government has to pay to the people who qualify for it, even though they're constantly trying to minimize the qualifications and the number of people who are on the rolls. They have to pay it. But unlike other entitlement programs, every year Congress has to allocate money. It has to be appropriated by Congress. Social Security is automatically funded.
Right.
So are other mandatory entitlement programs. So here we are, and state by state, they're the ones who administer food stamps, and they're unsure. Is there a month? Is there 6 weeks? Is there 2 months? Are we going to have to start tapering down on food stamp money? And they're not getting an answer from USDA. They don't know. In past years, there was a USDA $3 billion reserve fund for SNAP, but nobody knows what it is now, and USDA isn't answering questions.
You know, we were talking about the anxiety earlier today, and we have in earlier other days about federal workers, the 800,000 half furloughed, half forced to work. When do I get paid? Will I get paid despite the history? How do you feel if you're one of the 40 million people who's on food stamps, who is listening to us or reading these articles, not knowing if you'll even have supplemental assistance to buy food for your kids, for your family, come February? I mean, this is really, it's unconscionable what is being done to now potentially 10. And even again, even if it doesn't run out before the shutdown is over, the anxiety about it is just, it's unacceptable. It's just
And this understandable horrible. Hair trigger of anxiety. There was a technical outage of the EBT, the cards, they look like credit cards that are SNAP benefits, at a grocery store in Indiana over the weekend. And the press started reporting, hey, there's going to be no benefits. The government shutdown means no food stamps. So already that panic started to spread. And because USDA is being so secretive, or maybe just they don't know what the reserve is, that those panics are going to spread.
And by the way, we should say, as we, I think we said at the top of the show today when we discussed this just in passing, these are not just poor people who are looking for work. These are a lot of low-income people, families who are working, whose incomes are so low that they qualify for food stamps. So it's a whole swath, obviously 40
million
people.
It's not just that. It's, of course, it's not just that. But this is one of those issues that hits people you see every day at the grocery store.
Exactly.
And it hits students of mine at both BU and Tufts. And so it becomes a very personal issue.
So, over to Corby Comer.
This next one, I love this story. You know, everybody makes their New Year's resolutions, and the gyms are packed, and all the exercise vows are made. This one is about practically riots at the salad places in New York City.
It's great.
So, of course, the BPL is right across from Sweetgreen.
Yes.
And my office is right near Chopped, A Little Beet, and a Sweetgreen, all of which are these salad places, and I rely on them a lot, but that's because I'm virtuous every day of the year, as both you and Jim Barger and Jim are every day of the year. This is lines out the door, people throwing epithets at each other in line at Chopped because it's too slow. Because they want their New Year salad, whereas Chick-fil-A and McDonald's, oh boy, speaking of slow, they don't have any business at all.
It's a riot. It's a riot. Some guy was saying, you guys can go F yourselves in his Patagonia puffer vest when I guess he didn't get a salad.
Well, I think it's great. I mean, it is great. And the problem is it doesn't last. We start at Sweetgreen or the generic Sweetgreen,
packed.
We end up at McDonald's a week later. But
No. Whereas
like
those of us who are
virtuous
endlessly
all
virtuous.
The time, I know
now, Corby Comer.
No, you can have an app and order it online, and so you just
you
go
can.
In, and there is your bag decorously waiting for you.
You can, that's right.
So, Corby Comer, I remember a while ago we talked about the guy that realized that people had gluten problems, and there was some big article about him somewhere saying, but it's a real disorder. It's not just kind of a little thing that.
What guy? Who are we talking about?
I don't know. Do you remember his name, Corby? He was the physician or the researcher, or whatever he was, that realized.
Well,
that
there's a guy with a name like D'Alessio who came from the Middle West to our very own Mass General Hospital to head a gluten celiac.
I believe
disease,
this is the guy.
Research.
But what
yes.
was your point, Margaret?
Well, his
I'm
point
sorry.
Was he said that gluten intolerance seems to have taken over America, and he was saying it's not really that widespread. It's a small, happily,
people
a small
think
number
it is.
Of people that have this real celiac disorder. But it made me think of it because there's a story in the New York Times talking about that one in 10 adults, which is pretty significant still, have a genuine food allergy, but other people just kind of think they do, or
an equal number,
psychosomatic symptoms
says.
Or something?
Well, I don't even believe the estimate, but, you know, who am I? I don't have the data. What this study that's in JAMA Network Open, which means it hasn't, I think, which means it really hasn't been completely vetted by the Journal of the American Medical Association, but they thought it was good enough to put on their website, estimates that 10.8% of American adults have an allergy. So what does an allergy to a food mean? It means that you have hives, your lip or tongue swells, you can't swallow, your throat tightens, your chest tightens, you can't breathe, you wheeze, you vomit, chest pain. So it's very specific symptoms that almost everybody we know, or most people, not all by any means, who say they have food allergies, what they really mean is they get a headache, they have trouble digesting it, and those are food sensitivities, and they're not imagined. They're bad, they're painful, but they're not allergies. And allergy has become this catch-all phrase for, this doesn't agree with me.
Why do we care that there are, assuming that it's not bad faith, And assuming that the numbers are somewhere near what are being estimated, 1 in 10 really have a food allergy. An additional 1 in 10, according to this research, think they have a food allergy but only have what you call a food sensitivity. So what?
Well, what we care about is that restaurants follow the Mingzai Law, which the Massachusetts State Legislature enacted about 8 years ago, 7 years ago, that requires food service training about food allergies. Because if you really do have a tested, proven food allergy, it's dangerous. You can go into anaphylactic shock. You can go to the emergency room. The restaurant has to really not just say it hasn't put stuff in your food. It has to know how to avoid, you know, separate knives, separate cutting boards, entirely separate production lines.
You know, I didn't know about that law, and I'm curious to know how recently it passed, because of what I have noticed in the last 6 months, and I eat out a decent amount, that almost every time I eat out anywhere, the first thing
they
the
ask,
server says is, does anybody at the table have a food allergy? Is that as a result of
I feel
a law?
Sure it was about 7 to 8 years ago, and I think it took a year, speaking of something being passed but not being funded, it took a year maybe for the state legislature to start finding funds so that the state could help with the training
program. But is it required that a server ask the question, or is it just a safest thing for an employee of a restaurant to do?
I don't remember if there's a protocol when the diner comes in. I think there has to be a notice on the menu, maybe, if something contains certain allergens, especially peanuts and soy, and there has to be training for the workers.
We're talking to Corby Cummer. Corby, one of the most important stories we're talking about to you today, even though most people will say, are you kidding me, is the mug cake. Now, the reason why the mug cake, which you will describe, see, I knew it. Marjorie, of course, is laughing.
No, it's...
because, Marjorie, you've never been heavy. As someone who has been heavy off and on my whole life, I'm doing relatively well now. The biggest problem, the reason we are or have been the fattest nation on the planet, and I think we're number two now, but whatever, we're right up there and always have been. In my opinion, it's because of portion control. We are a nation of cheesecake factories, which essentially, for those who haven't been there, you order a meal and there's enough for your extended family on one plate. A mug cake is de facto portion control, isn't it?
Well, it is portion control, but it's still too much. So what is a mug cake? It is something that is really, it's a cake that you... it's one bowl cake, except it's one mug, meaning you don't have to get a lot of stuff dirty.
Exactly.
It's easy to make, and you make it in a microwave, not an actual oven. So in 3 minutes, you have a cake rather than, I think the Eater piece says, the unbearable 30 minutes to 35 minutes that an actual cake can take, along with a prep time. So what you're really making is kind of a fallen souffle. It doesn't have that much to do with cake because things with flour in them don't work at all well in the microwave. But you have somewhere between, you have a pudding cake, let's put it that
way. Yeah, sounds good.
In a mug, and you can, you know, mix it with whipped cream. You can get spray whipped cream and have yourself a very self-pitying and indulgent time. And it's one portion. It's just one big portion, Jim. It's not a small portion. It's still too much.
Well, it doesn't have to be. You can make a small mug cake. And by the way, I want to correct you, or at least amend what you said. There are two alternatives. Some of us would spray the whipped cream onto the mug cake.
Yeah.
Some would take a bite of the mug cake and just spray the whipped cream directly into our mouths.
Really?
So there are two alternatives.
You know, my very aged and completely wonderful stepmother, well over 90, does that. And
good
for
her.
When you live long enough, you get to do whatever you want to do.
Do you know, Corby, there was a very interesting statement in this story that said that...
the mug cake story?
Yes. Yeah. Up until and this was from The Guardian, that up until the age of 3 or 4, children have an enviable ability to stop eating when they are full.
Yeah, I love that.
At that age, the self-regulation of hunger is lost and sometimes never relearned. Because that is one of the interesting things I found just going through... I mean, I always tease you about this, that we would, at our old radio station, we could have a lot of free food.
Yeah.
You just would have finished eating some massive lunch, and then there's free food down the hall, and you run down the hall and get the free food.
Of course, it's free. Why wouldn't you?
But I think that's got something to do, and so you wonder about that, because if you feel full, why would you keep eating? But some people do keep eating.
Whatever happened to leptin and ghrelin is what I want to know. They are not characters in a Muppet series.
What are they?
They are two hormones that regulate satiety and feelings of fullness. And when they were first, their mechanisms were first discovered, the whole idea was, wow, when you feed leptin to mice, they stop eating as the minute they're not hungry. Can you do that with humans? The answer turned out to be, no, you can't. But ghrelin was also fat regulation that was supposed to help, and none of this has worked. But, right, we somehow lose this ability to understand when we're going to be full unless we are like Jim and we know how to wait 20 minutes for the feelings of satiety to kick in.
Can I tell you, Corby, I have not been hungry since 1984. I mean, No, I'm serious. I wish I'm like a dog. I have no appetite control, and I don't know if I had it till I was three
but
or four either.
Here's what I wonder, though, and this would be fascinating. We just talked about the mud cake. I can see where if you make somebody makes your favorite kind of cake, like our producer made this unbelievable fudge. What do you call those cakes?
God.
Flourless cakes for us for Christmas. She does it every year. They're great.
Our producer, otherwise known as Chelsea.
Yeah, yes. Chelsea makes these great cakes. I mean, I could eat half of that cake because it's really good. Or sweets, I guess I don't understand why you would keep eating like something that wasn't that exciting if you were full.
Because some of us have, there's a psychological aspect to eating too, and some people.
But would you do it with a salad? Would you do it with, I don't know, a cheeseburger? I don't know.
I'd say it's more
like. You sound like somebody who's talking to a smoker and saying, why do you like those things
anyway? Exactly. Because she's never lived it. Well, by the way, you're thin too there.
And you're a food critic.
But he gets it because he lives in the world of food. You don't get it at all. You don't use food to satisfy desires, like a lot of people on the planet do, me included.
Well, it depends what kind of food it is. If it's a nice, like, cheesecake, you'll get that cheesecake for Christmas. That was
from Sheila, one of our friends.
What was that store?
Juniors in Brooklyn.
Cheesecake. Boy, that was a great
and in
cheesecake.
Manhattan now, too.
I could eat a lot of that.
But, there's something else you're describing that goes back to the mug cake and it goes back to the ridiculous panic lines out the door at salad places, which is that you're thinking of this indulgence as a kind of seasonal one-time-a-year thing. Mm. And the way people are now, unfortunately, thinking of these virtuous salads as a January New Year's resolution thing they're just not going to bother with. But you don't have those kind of sweets, and you don't think it's the thing to do to pass around cheesecakes and chocolate cakes the rest of the year. And
right.
So it's fine for you to reserve it this time of year and enjoy it.
You know what's horrible? Marjorie knows this. You don't, but you won't be surprised. When I was a kid, when I probably had my greatest weight issues, I would partially defrost a Sara Lee banana or chocolate cake. And for those who don't know, they were like mini sheet cakes, but they were not that mini. I'd eat the whole damn thing. I mean, now that would never, other than when you were stoned when you were a kid, you would never have done that, Marjorie, correct?
Probably not. So
there's a whole love song to Sara Lee pound cake that was written by the composers of Cabaret in Chicago.
Is that true?
Really?
Yeah. It was a sort of nightclub act thing.
I could have performed it. We're talking to Corby Conner.
Okay, let's move on to my favorite story of the day. Are we there yet? Are we going to go to lionfish
first? You can go. First? It's fine. We can do either one you want.
This whole thing where a growing number of states are telling its citizens, including Massachusetts, that we can go out and shovel certain dead animals off the road and eat them. Roadkill is growing in appearances on the dining room plates of Americans.
What do you think?
I think it's a great idea.
So
I think, why are you wasting these dead animals that unfortunately met their end in an accident because of either a careless driver or bad lighting? There they are. People eat them. They are usable meat. Why should they go to waste? Now, states like Oregon, which just passed this, they restrict it to elk and deer.
Right.
So it can't be other animals. There's a lot that's gross about this. You have to learn how to butcher your own meat.
Yeah.
Starting from an entire dead animal, you have to turn over the animal's head and antlers to the wildlife agency with 5 business days because they will see, did that thing have brain disease? So was it bad or dangerous for you to eat? Of course, it's too late by then often. they're testing head tissue for chronic wasting disease.
Yeah.
But still, don't you think this should go to use rather than go to waste?
Absolutely. By the way, the other prohibition in the Oregon law, and I think it makes 27 states now, including Massachusetts and New Hampshire, is you cannot, quote, hunt with automobiles. Because
right.
The fear is that what people are going to do
running them over.
Is going to drive, look for an elk or look for a deer if you're in Oregon and purposely run into it so you can eat the damn thing and not have to buy food. But, one of the things we're going to talk to our listeners about, we talk a lot about veganism and is this the future? Should it be the future? On Twitter, I told Marjorie, I felt so... there was a video that was circulating this weekend that was so horrible about pigs in these crates, which
don't tell me,
can barely move, can barely lie down to
no
sleep.
No more bacon, Jim.
And roadkill, the beauty of roadkill is for those who are want to forsake meat, not for health reasons only, but for moral reasons. This roadkill thing is like the perfect escape clause, isn't it?
Well, it's an excuse if you don't want to have if you don't really particularly like meat. But when it comes to going online and reading the instruction, if the smell makes you want to barf, then just pass on it.
Yeah.
And the choicest carcasses are the ones that are hit in the head. And you have to learn how, but broken bones and bloodied flesh can be trimmed off. Gutting and butchering is otherwise similar to the process hunters use. So you have to be willing and up for this and understand this is where the meat I like comes from. Somebody did this.
You know, well, but so I'm sorry.
We also talk about the other thing that you are allowed
to eat. Before we get to that,
okay.
Can we stay on roadkill for one more second?
Yep.
Maybe you can explain this. New Hampshire apparently has no rules. There's a roadkill, you just go eat it.
Live for your dog.
Yes, exactly. But Massachusetts, we printed out this thing. Listen to this. The permit's required, as it is in Oregon. But in Massachusetts, you must submit the roadkill for state inspection. So you hit a deer in Ipswich, and then you drive it to downtown Boston or something and present it to an inspector. What do you do?
It used to be Jamaica Plain. The lab was in JP.
Really?
And you had to take animals to be tested for rabies. And dead animals that the Wildlife Service or police found went straight to JP.
Okay.
Well, that would take you an awful long time during which your roadkill is getting a little rancid on in the car, on the roof of the car.
No, I think it's like aging beef.
Oh, it's like aging. What do you mean?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, okay.
But when you when you hang pheasant and birds and other animals that you kill, it's to soften and tenderize the meat and bring out the flavors.
I didn't know that.
Marjorie's going to now introduce the whole notion of invasive species, because this industry that Marjorie and I are going to try to start for all of us who feel morally guilt ridden because we are eating meat and these sort of things. If you only ate roadkill and invasive species, you could assuage your guilt. What's the invasive species story?
Well, the invasive species is about something called lionfish down in Florida. I guess they came from some other faraway place, but somebody brought them here via an aquarium or something. And now these lionfish are eating up all the good fish, like the parrotfish that clean coral reefs down there, and they're ecologically damaging to the ocean.
Coral reefs, that sort
yes.
of stuff, yeah.
And so what they've done down there is they've had these massive lionfish kills where everybody comes in and they try to kill all these lionfish, and they're trying to just control the population. But we don't have lionfish here. We have Canada geese, and that's an invasive species.
It is?
Yes, and so we're allowed to kill... Not kill. I'm sorry. We're allowed to eat the dead Canada geese. I believe so. Because it's an invasive species.
Oh, really?
They're from Canada, Jim.
So what do you think of it? No, they're not from Canada, by the way.
They came straight
from
Quebec.
It is not named Canada goose because it's from Canada.
Okay, so now John Canada.
Exactly.
Okay, I was just trying to fool you there.
Sorry, well, I missed your point there. Okay, so what do you think about that? I mean, this whole notion that they're controlling invasive species by having a hunt, to me, sounds a little sketchy. Does it to you or no?
No, these are such a problem, lionfish. I tried to do some reporting on this a couple of years ago, and it was very hard to find a place that actually served lionfish or anywhere organized enough that it would have any for you to eat. Also, lionfish are very hard to clean. They have their ton of spines.
And
I don't know why that didn't come up in the story, which
they're
made it sound like it's the easiest thing. It's like
at.
A cod fillet.
Yeah. That's what they said, yeah.
But now with the organized kills, I think it's great because whenever you start reading about lionfish, what they do to oxygen, what they do to other species, they are, huge, appalling, and invasive, and you want to get rid of them as much as possible.
Have you ever
the idea that in Florida, the Upper Keys, where I was looking into going was Louisiana because there were chefs there that were trying to start to do them, and I am blanking on the name of a New Haven chef who does his own diving in Long Island Sound, comes back with invasive species, and he serves them at his restaurant in New Haven. It's the only East Coast, Northeast restaurant I know about that's doing it, but I think it's a great idea.
Yeah,
have you ever eaten roadkill?
Not knowingly, no.
Oh, okay. Hey, Corby, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time.
You?
Corby Kammer, thank you very much, as always. Great to talk to you. Corby Kammer joins us every week. He is a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a Boston Public Radio contributor.
Before you leave, by the way, this restaurant, I just looked it up, that Corby couldn't think of the name of the chef from.
Nope.
It uses invasive species for its sustainable sushi. It's in New Haven, Connecticut. It's called Maya, M-I-Y-A, apostrophe S, sushi.
Okay.
There you go. What do you mean, okay?
No, I'm just thinking, would it sound appetizing? This is an invasive species.
Well, Marjorie,
dish.
We're about to market the whole notion that all we should eat is invasive
yeah.
species
well, you
and
are.
Roadkill.
You are. I'm a little bit more skeptical of the whole
Not
thing.
Me.
Anyway, up next, we're going to ask you about that. Open lines and asking you, is roadkill the answer?
What are you laughing about? It is.
To affordable and sustainable.
Yes, it is.
Meat eating. Get out there in the Mass Pike this afternoon and see what you can find. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. You know, if you're just tuning in, we were talking to food writer Corby Kammer about what we see, at least one of us sees, as sustainable, cheap, and a humane way to eat meat and fish, feasting on roadkill and invasive species. You know, where some people, Marjorie, might see, I don't know, squash squirrel, others see supper. So we're going to open the lines and ask you, are you in? I am at 877-301-8970. If you want to enjoy the virtues of free meat with no additives, why not the fresh kill on the side
That's
of the
right.
road? And if you're a practitioner, we are dying to talk to you. How's it working for you? If you want to share some recipes, we want to hear it. And by the way, Tori Bedford, our colleague, came up with some beautiful recipes.
She did.
They have stewed, by the way, this is what it is. Stewed dog,
Ugh.
French fried skunk. These are real recipes. They look fabulous. My favorite, hedgehog spaghetti carbonara, which and possum soup. So if you have a recipe.
Hedgehog.
But can I tell you something? I do feel guilty. I don't feel guilty enough about eating meat, fish less so. But think about it. If there was a ready source of invasive
yeah.
species
well, you gotta be,
and roadkill, how much
made
better?
Of sterner stuff than you or I are. What this means is you're driving down the Mass
yeah.
Pike, you're by the Sturbridge exit, you see a poor deer that is dead in the side of the
yeah.
road. You get your shovel out, you put him, I guess, in the trunk of your car.
Yeah, I've done that many a time.
You drive home, you're going to know how to.
No, you don't drive home. You drive to JP or wherever you do.
No, that's not. That, well, it's in Massachusetts.
You have
that's
it
right.
inspected.
You do have to do that in Massachusetts.
You have it inspected.
You're better off finding it in New Hampshire.
Take 3 days off from work,
yeah.
have it inspected,
but
and then you take it home.
But then you have to gut it and butcher it. And I mean, can you imagine? And debone it? Like, you have to
okay,
be like
a
hunter
second.
Type person.
Let's make it a little bit easier.
I do know some hunters. I'm not one myself.
Okay, fine. That's shocking. Now, I mentioned to you Maya's sushi in New Haven.
Yes.
Forget, I wasn't talking about butchering a deer by myself.
Yeah.
That's not one of my areas of expertise.
Eat the invasive species.
How about if it turns out there was a restaurant in town that specialized, at least part of their menu, was roadkill and invasive species. You wouldn't order that?
No, I would not.
And why is that, please?
Because I just don't want to think about it. I don't
What's
want
to not
think
to think about
it? And I know that's hypocritical.
Wait, it's
I know
better that
these...
they shoot a deer or slaughter a cow?
You're right. You're right. But there's just something about roadkill which might put a damper in my appetite. I have to be
well,
honest. Even though I am eating things that are, you know, the chickens and I when I go to restaurants, I don't know where the chicken comes from. I'm not
exactly.
always asking, was this a well-raised chicken with enough space to turn around and all that kind of stuff. But I do try to buy my meat at Whole Foods.
Oh, number five? You do the number
yes,
five
Yes, I do
thing.
These sustainably.
877-301-8970. I am total. I didn't even know about these laws until this morning.
Neither
Oregon became, I think, the 27th state. As I said, Massachusetts and New Hampshire have already allowed the eating of roadkill. And by the way, if one of our producers could look, can you see if there are any restaurants in Massachusetts or New Hampshire which actually serve roadkill or invasive species? We'd love to publicize them. What are you laughing about?
Robert, he says it would solve a lot of problems. Imagine a nice age conservative Republican with a fine Chianti.
That's not even funny. You know, 877-301-8970. And by the way, different states limit the kind of animals. I think like Corby or you said, in Oregon, it can only be an elk or a deer. In other states, it can be more broadly kind of things. But if there are health protections in place,
mm-hmm.
I don't understand what your concern. Would you, theoretically, that deer, let's stay with the deer for a minute, was killed unintentionally, as opposed to the slaughter of deer, so that people can, what's deer meat? Venison? Is that what
venison.
It's called? Venison. They can eat venison. Isn't it better to do the roadkill where it was an innocent taking of a life rather than a slaughter of a deer?
You go right ahead, Jim. It's fine. Go right ahead.
I bet you the listeners, are going to be with me with this. Let's start in New Hampshire.
Steven says there's nothing like fresh meat on the grill.
Thank you very much.
Of your car.
Oh, that's a good one. Thank you, Margie. I'd explain it, which is a problem. Matthew in New Hampshire, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Have you ever done it? Would you?
I've eaten plenty of invasive species.
Like what?
Never roadkill personally. I like to shoot my meat myself personally, especially squirrel, when it's in season.
Yeah. And
A lot of people don't know that it's squirrel season. It's a $200 fine per squirrel if you shoot them out of season.
Is that when is squirrel season? Because I was thinking of doing some squirrel hunting myself this year. When is
September 1st, December 31st.
To December 31st. Now, you're in New Hampshire. We are told that a place called The Joinery in New Market, New Hampshire, serves invasive green crab, according to New Hampshire Public. You ever been there?
I have never been there. I am very familiar with invasive green crabs, though. I don't know if you've ever done any saltwater fishing, but you just can't get away from the little things.
No, you can't. Now, Matthew.
I was just wanted to say that in New Hampshire, they actually let you, with a normal saltwater fishing license, have, I believe it was either 3 or 5 crab or lobster traps.
Ooh.
And there's a limit on the native rock crabs and lobsters, but there is no limit of any kind on green crabs. So if you just want to get a million of the little guys and make crab cakes or seafood stock or whatever, you can go ahead with it.
Now, before you leave us, Matthew, I have never eaten squirrel. Have you ever eaten squirrel, Marjorie?
No, I have not.
I assume it tastes like chicken, because everything does. What does it taste like, Matthew?
It does not taste like chicken. It's a dark meat. It actually does have a bit of a nutty flavor. It's a little bit unique. It is important when you're eating it to be very careful of all the little bones. That's one
that's
caveat.
I don't think Marjorie's doing that.
With any meat, you want to cook it low and slow, because they're moving around. They're jumping through the trees all the time, so that meat's kind of tough, and you got to sort of loosen it up a bit.
Yeah. Thank you, Matthew, for the recipe
Makes
advice and for your personal experience.
Nutty,
by the way, another
it?
One, Marjorie. Have you ever heard of Chef Matt Lewis of Moxie in the Great Portsmouth, New Hampshire? He also serves invasive. What do you mean? Okay, invasive green crab.
I just don't want to think
about
it.
You know, I don't think you're thinking rationally about this.
I'm not.
What
thinking
is the
problem?
Well, you're not. So
you have to be kind of in tune with what you're eating. An invasive green crab is just not something that I want to.
You ever eaten goose?
No.
In your whole life, you've never eaten goose?
No, I have not.
You've never tried a goose?
Well, maybe I've had, which I shouldn't have because it's supposed to be a terrible thing. No, foie gras. Isn't that from geese?
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, which we're not supposed to eat anymore because it's a terrible thing. Now, Art from West Bridgewater, he says he knows several people on town roadkill list down there in West Bridgewater. He says he was on for a while. And what happens is the town gets a call for a dead deer, and they call down the roadkill list until they find somebody who wants to come take it.
Are you okay with that?
And nobody gets the carcass tested.
Are you okay with that?
Well, like I said,
you have to have the carcass tested. That's state
Art's
law here.
He says nobody does.
Well.
He's a hunter. He probably knows how to do all this stuff. If he wants to go out and do it, you know, more power to
him.
Want
me to teach you how to slaughter a deer?
No, I don't. You see it, but you know what you see on the road all the time, though? You see skunks and raccoons.
Well, we have a recipe for skunk here, too, don't we?
Yes, we do have a recipe for skunk.
Was it French fried skunk?
Yeah, sounds wonderful.
Sounds easy, too.
And they have to tickle the fur
off. Only problem is it says you need 2 skunks. And you need 2 cups of bear fat. How do you get bear fat?
I don't know. Eric says, what about parasites or wild animals?
Well, you go get a test.
Regulated.
That's what I said. Adelaide, you're in Hamilton. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, Jim Marjorie.
Hey.
I'm so glad you're doing this topic. I'm a young woman. I live on the Hamilton Ipswich line.
Yeah.
And I am recently adding myself to my local list, like your previous emailer called, so I can get a phone call to go pick up roadkill in my area.
So wait a second, Adelaide, before you go ahead, is there a list in your community, like whoever it was that mentioned it a minute ago, Art or somebody, is there such a list?
Absolutely, like Hamilton, Ipswich, Rowley, up here, North Shore.
That's great.
Yeah. And now, so I have a friend recently who just got called up to Ipswich and picked one up, and he actually lives in JP, which is convenient.
Uh-huh.
But I have a pickup truck, and I would call a friend, and I can't be that hard. Like, I mean, I can butcher a chicken. Like, I feel like I can figure it out.
Now, Adelaide, since you're a listener of the show, I assume you'd be kind enough. If Marjorie were to get some roadkill and was not able to butcher it herself, I assume you would butcher it for her. Yes. Is that correct?
I don't plan to have a lot of experience doing it, but I'm like pretty handy. And I have something to say about the green crabs as well. So Marjorie, yeah, you call me and I'll get together some of my redneck friends and I'll come and help you.
She's got to get some of her redneck friends.
Yeah.
Adelaide, you have exactly the right attitude about this, unlike Marjorie. Thank you very much.
Listen to this. This is from Sarah. She says, we had roadkill last night.
They did?
She said her husband's a hunter. He grabbed a deer that had been hit by a car, contacted the Mass Environmental Protection, whatever, and they said they don't want good stuff wasted, told him he could tag the deer and just had to check it at the local checking station. She says they have more than 65 pounds of meat in our freezer now to feed our family.
So, by the way, your alternative, because you're squeamish about this, what's that woman's name?
Sarah.
I'm totally with Sarah. Because you're squeamish about it, so we should waste all this, like, 65 pounds of venison?
No, I'm not saying.
What should we do about it?
If Sarah wants to do it, Nard wants
to do
it.
Why don't you want to do it?
Because, Jim, I just don't see myself picking up a shovel.
Adelaide said she's going to help you with the damn
thing.
Yeah, okay.
It's just not something. You know, I'll just have a couple of eggs. You know, I'll just eat a peanut butter sandwich.
Okay, Thomas.
It's just too much for me. It's
in New
too
Bedford.
Far.
You're next on Boston Public Radio. We had a great time at your whaling museum on Saturday there, Thomas. Welcome.
Oh, yeah, I missed you down there.
Well, you missed the great event. You should go next year. Next year will be the 24th annual Moby Dick Marathon. It's great. Go ahead, Thomas.
Well, when I used to, on my place site to work, they used to have a thing called pseudo chicken on the menu.
What is it?
And that was actually rabbit, which admittedly one of our guys used to grow tons of rabbit and bring the necks and sell it to the cafeteria. Hmm. And none of the girls knew it was pseudo chicken, what pseudo chicken was. And it was actually called bunny rabbit. So if you call something differently, you can, you know, do your possum, your skunk, whatever, and people won't know.
So are you suggesting this to assuage some of the concerns that Marjorie has? Is that what you're saying, by the way?
Maybe. Yeah.
That's actually an excellent idea. Thomas, thank you for
Listen
the call.
This.
We hope to see you next year.
Lizzie from Boylston just emailed. Mm-hmm. She said somebody hit a deer a few years back in front of her house. The cops came, but nobody in the roadkill list, I guess they have one up there too, wanted to come get it, so they didn't want to see it go to waste. She and her husband went out and started Googling how to gut a deer at 5 o'clock in the morning. And they did it. And then they took the clean deer to a local backyard butcher who cut it up. And like the Sarah, who's got 65 pounds of meat in her freezer, she's got 70.
Why don't you and I just drive around this weekend and look for it? I'm serious, for a dead animal.
If you and I drive around this weekend, I can tell you where we're going.
Where are we going?
We're not going to look for roadkill.
By the way,
we're going to the pot shop.
Tori just... We're having Kim Driscoll on tomorrow, by the way, who's the mayor of Salem.
Right.
Maybe
she's
she can help
there.
You out. Incidentally, Tori just typed something quite interesting on our screen there that she says, I called you Marguerite, which, as you know, is a constant refrain
right.
from many of our listeners and our boss.
I didn't hear
did
it.
Did you hear it?
I did not hear it.
Neither
no,
did
I didn't.
Where do you want to go next?
Okay, let's go
by
to...
By the way, do you notice that every single emailer or caller has either done it or is supportive of this? You're the one outlier. Do you know that?
I guess,
yes,
yeah,
Jim,
no,
I
guess, because there's a lot of people that are emailing, too, saying that they do this quite regularly.
I just
there's
said
more
that,
and
yeah,
more of
exactly.
them. I'm getting recipes.
You are? Like, yeah. Do you have anyone that's interesting?
Well.
I think finding bear fat is going to be difficult for the French fried skunk or whatever it was that we're talking about a minute ago, because I don't think
For anyone who's interested, older editions of the famous Joy of Cooking.
That's not true.
Yes.
Roadkill?
From before 1984 have recipes. I have an
old I have
old
an old
joy.
One, so do I,
so
actually.
So do I. I have an old one.
I know you do. You
and they have
that.
Recipes with directions for skinning and cleaning for opossum, porcupine, squirrel, raccoon, muskrat, woodchuck, armadillo.
I've done it for the armadillo.
Elk, moose, bear, and wild boar.
Let's go to, you remember who shot a wild boar purportedly?
Bill Weld.
Governor Weld.
Yeah,
Andrew.
He shot the wild boar.
It was in an enclosure.
Poor wild boar. Didn't have a chance.
It wasn't wild, I guess. Andrew and Rockland, you're next. We're talking about roadkill and invasive species as the basis for our future diets. Hi there, Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
So I pick up roadkill deer whenever I get a chance.
Sure.
Wow.
I'm a hunter.
Yeah.
And the secret is, or the trick is that it's got to be a weather thing. So when you get the animal, you know, a deer that's hit the summertime, you know, when it's hot out, you know, it starts decomposing immediately. So you got to get it gutted, get it hung. So during the winter months, it's perfect. So you can hang it for a day or so, then you can butcher it up, and you got meat for the winter and springtime and all that.
Andrew, I know this will shock you, but neither Marjorie nor I are hunters. And Marjorie is, as you've probably heard, a little squeamish about this whole thing. If she were to come upon a dead deer on the road that had been hit by an automobile or a truck, what advice would you give her if she wanted to give this a try? Whose help could she seek? What would she do?
I mean, I don't know if I had to say who she would ask. I'd be glad to help her.
There you go, Marjorie.
Thank you.
And what the first thing you do is you put it up on the roof, right? You could do that, Marjorie, couldn't you? The dead deer, just plop it up on the roof?
It's like
Mitt Romney's dog, Seamus.
You just put it up there. Seamus was alive.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, he was alive. But, you know, Andrew, if you're not a hunter like yourself, I mean, it takes some skill to know how to do this, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I assume somebody...
Well, it's all practice.
Practice, like anything else.
Yeah.
We weren't that good at talk radio when we started either,
Marjorie. So let me
ask
you something. When you cook up the venison, what do you do with it? How do you do it? What's your favorite venison recipe?
Mm. My favorite is the back strap. So that's the piece of meat that runs along the spine.
Yeah.
And you cut it up in medallions, and it's thick. Ooh. And you put them on a hot pan, fry them for a minute tops on each side. Venison, if you overdo venison, it's terrible.
Yeah. Huh.
So you have to have it, you know, at the most... medium.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely delicious. It's the greatest meal. My friends come over and they call it bumper meat.
Bumper meat. Andrew, thank you for your call. There's nothing that Andrew said that sounds appealing to you. It sounds from beginning to end. That was perfect. Think about it.
Well, you probably have had venison.
I've had venison many times. I like it.
Wonderful.
Oh,
okay.
So you don't even like the idea, even no matter why. You don't like venison to begin with.
No,
well,
how about a chicken?
You hit a chicken on the road.
Chicken,
how about a chicken?
I don't know. I mean,
what if I hit a
smaller.
Chicken on the road and I brought it over to your house? What about that?
Well, you hang it upside down, like
Andrew said. So whatever, hang it right side up or do something.
I go to the supermarket, and I ask the butcher for some skin.
By the way, don't you think that if you brought a roadkill, let's say chicken, for argument's sake?
Yeah.
Or you, to your butcher. Your butcher would take care of it.
Well, that's
for
what somebody
you.
Just said.
Sure.
They brought the deer to the butcher.
Absolutely.
And the butcher took care of it for them. And, you know, as many people have pointed out, there's no hormones
or antibiotics
or none of those things that you get if you buy your meat at a non-Whole Foods
So how about
place.
This as a compromise for starters?
What?
Let's assume we find a deer that was hit by a car.
Yep.
We hang it upside down in your kitchen, for starters, from the ceiling or something like that, for a couple of days, and then we take it to a butcher. Would that not be a satisfactory compromise?
I don't want things hanging in my kitchen. I just don't want to look at them.
However, not a dead deer, nothing.
I might be able to go for the hedgehog spaghetti carbonara.
Yeah, that'd
be
fabulous.
I love spaghetti.
What
love
is
spaghetti
that recipe?
Carbonara.
I love the carbonara.
Yeah, well, you have to cut up the hedgehog into small chunks.
You can do that, Jim. You need lean hedgehog, it says here.
And eggs and cream together, Parmesan cheese and all that kind of stuff.
Well, that sounds...
You put the hedgehog chunks in a pan with olive oil on medium heat. I don't know. I just did.
I think you've got to be more adventurous.
Okay.
And also, by the way, you're a moralist, and in many ways.
I'm not.
You don't like, whenever we talk about how animals are slaughtered, you get upset. Every time we've ever done this, you get upset about it. This is the alternative. You don't have to give up meat. You don't have
right.
to give up
fish.
Right.
It was an accident.
Exactly. Or the invasive species, which are doing, they're destroying, these lionfish are destroying the coral reefs of Florida.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't want to eat one of those for lunch?
Well, I don't really like fish. I'm not a protein kind of person.
You're not.
You know what I mean? I'm a carbohydrate kind of person.
Fine.
Let's go to Alyssa in Bridgewater.
Hi, Alyssa.
Are you on the list down there in Bridgewater? We have Art from West Bridgewater has a list in his town. You got one too, Alyssa?
Hi, Alyssa.
Oh, a list of what?
The roadkill people, the people that are willing to come pick up the roadkill.
You get called by the cops or something.
Yeah, they have you on a list.
Oh, well, I'm not on that list because I have a little vegan perspective. Marjorie, I'm sensing a little cognitive dissonance here.
I think so.
You know,
too.
You say that you want to be in tune with your meat. You're not in tune with it when it's coming from a factory farm. You're more so in tune with it when it, you know, runs out of someone's backyard and gets hit by a car. And I have to say, I agree with the hunters more here. And, you know, people say veganism is extreme, but isn't this getting a little extreme? You know, dragging dead animals off the road? Why not just have, like, you know, some tofu, spinach?
Well, listen, I'm a total hypocrite on this. I mean, I am not saying that I'm a food purist at all, although I do try to buy my meat and my milk at places where they're not sticking, you know, what's the thing at Whole Foods where you go from 1 to 5?
It's a rating thing, I don't know.
Where they,
what it's
you know,
called.
The most humanely raised. I mean, I don't know if they're telling me the truth or not, but I try to do that. But, you know, there's no, I'm not a principled eating person. I mean, I'm eating eggs. I'm eating
Alyssa,
all these things.
I have good news for you. We were told by Chelsea before the show today, our quiz guests on Friday, and we do a quiz, a news quiz, every Friday at the Boston Public Library studio. Our quiz guests are people who are listening to the show, I don't know, a few months ago when you and I were talking about how if we knew people who could introduce us to creative, good-tasting veganism, we might give it a try. And they're apparently vegans who are coming, who are going to try to introduce us in a way that you would find wonderful, Alyssa. So tune in Friday about 1:30 or before. Thanks so much. You know what my motto is? More we're having this, waste not one night. You've heard me say that
exactly.
Many a time, haven't you? And that's what this is here. If roadkill is waste not, want not food, is it not?
It absolutely is. I mean, you're taking advantage of a sad situation where an animal was run over by a car, and it's best, mm-hmm. apparently, if the animal was hit in the head,
yeah.
And that's the way to go. And so you're getting it off the road, you're performing a public service, and you're not wasting the food, and that's great. It's just not.
And you're not killing an animal specifically so that you can have a piece of meat.
Right. That's one of the rules. You can't be driving your car around looking for animals to run over.
Well, that's in Oregon. Oregon prohibits hunting by automobile is what they call it. I don't know about all these other states.
No, I mean, I have to say we have a lot of people in the emails and the callers who are very down with roadkill.
If anybody has made hedgehog spaghetti carbonara, could you call us really quickly? No, seriously, and let Marjorie know how it went.
Nicholas just emailed to tell me there's no cream in carbonara, but I hate to tell you, there is cream in this hedgehog spaghetti carbonara recipe, so maybe it's a fraudulent...
I thought there was cream, too.
...fraudulent recipe, but that's what it calls for, Nicholas, but thank you for the email. Do we have time for one more?
One more, yeah.
Okay, Christina in the car. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. So, I love your show, but I have to tell you about my husband, who, when he was about 10, he and his friend Ricky used to be given roadkill from their various neighbors, and they would skin them and then stuff them and put them into their museum. Their most complicated case was a skunk, which of course they had to be extremely careful because they were worried that they would set off the smell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, Christina, when you say they're a museum, what did they stuff them or something and just put them in a...
Yes, yes. Yes, I think they had maybe a little shed in the back and they made a little museum.
Huh.
Of their stuffed animals.
Huh. And boy,
he doesn't do this anymore.
He doesn't do it anymore. Was he eating these things or just stuffing them? What was his deal?
No, just stuffing them. Just
he was.
Stuffing them.
Okay, well, Christina, thank you very much, and say hi to your husband for us. 877-301-8970. We're waiting for John Ging, so we have a couple of seconds here. Mm-hmm. Are you at all persuaded by the fact? I bet you if I had said to you before this segment that where would you guess the vast majority of our listeners would be on this? You would say probably not into it. Like you, every single emailer, I think, or virtually every single emailer, and every single caller has said they'd either tried it or they'd love to try it or they'd be on the list. That kind of list from Mark from West Bridgewater.
Well, I suppose it's one of those things where, you know, you think there is something you really wouldn't want to eat. In my case, maybe like an octopus. I don't think I'd like to eat an octopus.
You've never eaten octopus?
No. But then if you go somewhere and you have it, you know, you're not sure what it is and you're eating some kind of soup and then it winds up as octopus soup or an octopus in your salad or something, and you think, oh, wow, it's not so bad. I just think it's I'm sort of a dull person when it comes to
eating. Well, that really has nothing to do with this. This is not about not knowing, even though that caller suggested that before. This is about knowing consciously. You occasionally like to eat meat in some amount.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a choice between eating it where it was slaughtered, which you don't like, or eating it where it happened to be killed by a car, a truck, or that sort of thing, that should be fine. Isn't that a wonderful alternative?
No, it's irrational.
So here's the deal.
It's like Anthony Bourdain.
What about
him? You know, in the late, great Anthony Bourdain, when he had those shows, and he'd be off in some faraway country eating all these exotic things that just I thought, I love to watch the show, but I thought I would never eat that in a million
years.
Well,
here's the deal. Marjorie and I, in addition to having these vegan guests on Friday for the quiz, we are going to try, I'm speaking for Marjorie here, starting from this point forward, to only eat roadkill and invasive species. Can we speak to the Newsfeed Cafe about limiting our menu to that?
Yeah, okay.
You're eating a turkey portobello.
I'm eating a turkey
Would you
portobello.
Not feel far better if that was a roadkill turkey rather than
probably,
a slaughtered turkey?
You know, I feel terrible. It's probably a tortured turkey, and I'm doing a terrible thing. I admit I'm a hypocrite, and I'm not...
Before we leave this, anybody who's got a great roadkill or invasive species recipe, if you could... I'm serious. I'm totally serious. Please send it to bpr@wgbh.com. www.johnking.org, and we'll read them someday this week.
Okay, we're going to talk with John King from CNN in just a couple of minutes about what they're going to do about the president's speech tonight. Are they going to have an instant fact check or let the Democrats figure it out? He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Join us online to go over the latest political headlines, and there are plenty of CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John is also the anchor of Inside Politics, which we're just watching out of the corner of our eye, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8. Happy New Year there, John King.
Happy New Year. I missed you guys.
We missed you as well.
We missed you too. I kept looking on the TV. I said, where's John? I'm glad that you're back. So it's very upsetting,
two
John.
Two marvelous weeks off. I took 2 weeks off.
Good for you.
But it's very upsetting, you know, when your regular hosts are not there. You know what I'm saying, John? It's really, maybe they should do like a little stand-in, like a virtual John, one of those.
You had two choices. You could either take 2 weeks off like John did or do tequila shots like Anderson Cooper did on New Year's Eve. You could do one of the two.
Yeah. So, John, the president's going to speak tonight at 9 o'clock prime time about the border situation. What can we expect?
I'm fascinated by this in the sense that it is contrarian, which is so typical for the Trump presidency, in the sense that it's his first Oval Office address. He's never done this as president. When he had the strikes in Syria, he did it from the diplomatic room or the East Room or the cross halls, they call it. Sitting at that desk brings extra gravitas to it, and then he's going to go to the border to try to sway public opinion and to try to sway key votes in Congress on an issue on which he's losing right now. And so here's a president who could not get the border wall from a Republican Congress for 2 years, who just lost an election, was now asking Congress for more. Normally, you would have to ask for less. The Democrats just took charge of the House. Nancy Pelosi says there will be zero money for the wall. The president's not only asking for the wall, he's asking for more money for the border, and he says it's a crisis. The unanswered question, will he say there's a national emergency and try to invoke presidential powers? Most reporting is that he's going to say that he's thinking about that, but not make a final decision by tonight. But my big question is, is the president here just talking to his base? Is this all about 2020, saying that he's going to keep fighting for this promise? Or is he going to try to do something to change the equation? Two-thirds of Americans oppose the wall. Can this president, who repeatedly, forgive me, lies about this stuff, gives misleading numbers about this stuff, can he sit in this revered place, the Oval Office, and change public opinion? Is that even his goal? Or is this just all about the base and he's just going to keep blaming Democrats for a shutdown that is much more his responsibility than theirs?
Speaking of a term you used carefully, lie, and obviously we all read the Washington Post's tally of the number of lies in the 7,000 from last year that the president told. There's a story in the Washington Post about fact-checking the speech, and there's a lot of pressure on networks like yours to do that. I was not aware in this piece that's by Isaac Stanley Becker, it mentions the end of November, CNN made an attempt to fact check a White House press briefing in real time. I missed that. How did that go? And is that something that you guys are contemplating for tonight, as far as you know?
We're going to try to do it if possible. One of the things you have to do, especially in this age, it's hard to do in real time. If the president says, the moon is square, that's easy to fact check. If the president says pigs fly, that's easy to fact check. Some numbers are subject to debate. And so we have to be careful in these situations. Another thing, I would say this about anybody in the news business. It is critical that we hold everybody accountable. Mm-hmm. It is critical that we hold the president of the United States perhaps even more accountable, because that's the highest office in the land. It is critical when you have a president who has a casual relationship with the truth, and to the Trump supporters out there, if you don't believe me, you have a supercomputer in your hand, you're in your phone, you can do this research yourself. You don't have to believe me. He misstates, he exaggerates, and he lies all the time. That's part of his political MO. One of the challenges, though, when he says you're fake and you're the one making it up, is when you want to hold him accountable, you better be right. which is why I think what we do here at CNN, the Glenn Kessler in the, at the Washington Post, mm-hmm. some other news organizations. There was a Fox anchor who called Tara Sanders out on live television the other day. And
Chris
held
Wallace,
her accountable.
Yeah. It was great.
Yeah. Who held her accountable when she used misleading information. I think it's critical for our business. It's critical for our democracy. And we and I'll say this very clearly. We have the same responsibility as the Democrats take power in the House, as these new governors get sworn in all across the country. And they say things, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. Hold them accountable. Challenge their facts. Well, that's our job in this business. And this with this president, you know, you need extra batteries because he keeps breaking the fact-check machine. But that's part of our job.
I don't want to get lost in the weeds here, but how does this work? I mean, is there going to be a crawl beneath at the bottom of the screen as the president is talking? Is it just going to be a panel with one of your anchors afterwards? How does one do what you're saying CNN and I assume some other places are going to try to do, fact check tonight?
We will do it, my understanding, unless something happened while I was preparing for my show today, is that we will do it right out of the speech. That we will not, you know, we're not going to interrupt the president's speech and, you know, have a buzzer on TV or something that says, you know, he's lying. He's giving a speech from the Oval Office, and we need to respect that. We need to respect the office. We need to respect him. He's the president of the United States. But afterwards, we will have panel discussions, and we'll go through the night, and we'll do some of this tonight. And again, some of the stuff we might say that's questionable or that's in debate and try to answer it by tomorrow. And sometimes we will say, here's what one organization says. Here's government numbers that say this. Here's government numbers that say that. Because some of this stuff is not black and white. But when the administration says there are, you know, 4,000 terrorists, we need the border wall because of 4,000 terrorists. Our Pam Brown did some great reporting that 12 terrorists between October 2017 and October 2018, 12 suspected terrorists were apprehended at the southern border. Mike Pence, again, this morning on television said 4,000 and then said 3,000. I went to Boston Latin School. They did a pretty good job teaching us math. 12 and 3,000, there's a bit of a gap there. And so those are the things we need to hold them accountable for. The president has said on many occasions the wall's already being built. No, it's not. They're doing some repairs on parts of the wall that were built in previous administrations. So some of this is unfortunately easy to say. That's not true. Some of it is more, you know, debatable, and we'll try to do our job and do it. The bigger point here, Jim and Marjorie, not to ramble, is I don't understand this moment in the sense that my question for the president is, does he actually want a border wall or border security that includes at least part of a wall, improved border security that includes part of a wall, or does he just want this issue? Because he won in part on this issue, and a lot of people listening to me didn't vote for him. A lot of people listening to me don't agree with him. But George W. Bush won the election, a disputed election, lost the popular vote, got his tax cut. Donald Trump could get border security. That's a safe issue for him. Border security is a big safe issue. The wall itself, the particulars of the wall are unpopular. He could have gotten more out of the Republican Congress if he stayed to it. He could have gotten a DACA deal to give the Dreamers protections and gotten a lot of wall money if he had stuck to it. But he has never stuck to it because of fear of his own base. Is he actually ready to do a deal now, or does he just want to amp this issue up, hoping that he can somehow carry it over into 2020 and win again? I don't know the answer to that.
You know, this is not fact-checkable, but my opinion, and it's a function of Marjorie having said it on the air the other day, I think it's all about the base, as evidenced by his reaction to a whole variety of things when Rush Limbaugh and particularly Ann Coulter speak, including the other day on that, what is this, Mike Simone's podcast or something, saying Trump's going to cave. And I think the more that Coulter plays him, the more likely it is that he decides he can't move because Coulter has such influence with the Trumpian base. So again, I know that's not a fact-checkable item, but I would suggest that's where it is. Before we get to the underlying, the policy thing for one more minute, John, I have one more question about tonight. Can you remember a time when the lead members in the House and the Senate of the other party, assuming I'm right, I saw this on CNN screen, that Pelosi and Schumer were giving the rebuttal. Can you remember a time when those are the people who delivered a rebuttal to anything the sitting president did?
No, I'm guessing if we went back in time, maybe in the pre-cable television days, that was more of a tradition after the State of the Union. I don't know that. I'm just guessing that, you know, in the days when things were done more predictable by stature of office, just the fact that there is a response is unusual. When a president gives an Oval Office address, this is not a State of the Union. On the State of the Union, the other party always gets a response. But Pelosi and Schumer screamed to the networks, saying essentially that the president has a history of lying, especially on this issue. And if you're going to give him this time, and remember the broadcast networks said no to President Obama when he wanted to give an immigration address.
Right.
And so, you know, the Trump White House argument was we're in the middle of this government shutdown, so there's a big national issue anyway, and they make the case that there's a crisis at the border. Again, this is subject to your personal politics and opinion, but the numbers don't support that in terms of the number of people crossing the border, the number of apprehensions, the number of arrests. Those numbers are not historically mind-blowing by any means to suggest that this is different than, say, 2000 or 2 years ago or whatever. But the president wants to make that case, and the president is entitled to make that case. But the networks decided to take it, and then the pressure from the Democrats was there's no way, you cannot do this. Because he's going to say things that aren't true, and we have the right to equal time. And they decided to do that, which is in and of itself remarkable. That Pelosi and Schumer decided they are the ones to do that, I think, look, this is a big risk for the president. Can he sway public opinion? Can he sway key members of Congress? Or in the end, will he lose members of his own party? Will Republicans, after this speech, start voting with the Democrats to reopen the government? That's the gamble for the president. I do think Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, they're members of Congress, number one, which automatically makes them unpopular, whatever your party. Nationally. So are they the best spokesman for the party? They have decided that the leaders have to, answer the leader, if you will. It makes perfect sense that you take your two most senior Democrats to answer the most senior Republican. But there's a risk for them, too. I'm fascinated by what conversation are we going to be having, tomorrow, and then the president goes to the border on Thursday and sort of doubles down on this crisis argument, which guarantees the government shutdown is not ending this week, by the way. For the nearly a million Americans who aren't going to get a paycheck the next time the pay rolls around. We forget about the human beings and the human consequences of this sometimes.
Not here, we don't.
Good. And so this is going to continue until the president wants to play this out. And I don't mean that as cynically as it sounds. He's decided this is important. Let's give him a chance. Let's listen to him. Let's see if he can convince us, if he has real facts and numbers, and see if he can sway. That's his job, is to try to sway votes and sway public opinion. But it does guarantee that we're getting through the end of this week before you have new negotiations, because the Democrats are going to see if the president can make his case, and they're going to try to counter it. And that will reset, if you will, the parameters of any negotiations.
So I think you just touched on what may be the only way for this to end, before weeks go by, is if Republicans start peeling away from the president. How can this end? I mean,
I want to know that answer too.
Yeah.
Cory Gardner from Colorado has said he'd vote for a reopening without the wall. Susan Collins has toyed with it. Are there more Republicans hinting that this is Trump's last chance to make his case?
You have seen Tom Tillis, who's up for re-election in North Carolina, who's much more conservative than Cory Gardner or Susan Collins. That's not enough right now to convince Mitch McConnell. Three or four is not going to be enough to convince Mitch McConnell to go to the president and say, sir, let's have a plan B or a plan Z. So it's not there yet. But will enough Republicans just say, no, Mr. President, you had your chance, you gave your speech, you went to the border, we are not convinced, we're taking heat, we have TSA agents and other federal employees in our districts who aren't getting paid, stop, this has to end, and start sending him bills. If Republicans sign on to bills to reopen the government, which they have not, which they are not, but if after this the president fails to convince enough people and that starts to happen, is the president going to veto legislation to reopen the government? That would be an interesting scenario. And the other question is, will the Democrats blink? Let's not put this all on the Republicans.
Yeah, what can the Democrats do to end this mess?
This is what I don't understand about the president. Before the election, Chuck Schumer was open to a deal. Nancy Pelosi in the minority in the Democrats was open to a deal that, to protect the Dreamers, we will give you wall money.
Right.
Now, Nancy Pelosi, in her early days as Speaker, says no money for the wall. Is that a firm, ironclad position, or is Nancy Pelosi open to going to her members and saying, it's time to reopen the government. The Senate wants to go to $3 billion. Chuck Schumer will split the difference, if you will. President wants 5.7. Senate will give him 2.5 or 2.8. And assuming the president then says, okay, we'll do a traditional Washington deal, we'll split the difference or come close to splitting the difference, will Nancy Pelosi even bring that to the floor now?
Well,
logic says you just lost the election, Mr. President. You're going to get less. he's asking for more. But logic doesn't always apply in the age of Trump.
But what about the dreamers? I mean, this would seem to be a good time, although maybe he would never sign, that is, Trump would never sign a thing that would okay the dreamers staying.
He's afraid of Ann Coulter on the wall. You think he's going to give what they call amnesty?
But
this is a great, if only Nixon can go to China, maybe Trump will surprise us on this, which is why I rule nothing out, Marjorie. But if we're viewing this in the context of, this is first and foremost, and thank you for saying how much you focus on it. This is first and foremost about people.
Right.
Who aren't going to get a paycheck. And most of those people paycheck to paycheck, or close to it anyway, and have to pay tuition, have to pay a mortgage, have to buy a subway card or pay for their gas. But it's also about 2020. And it's also about Nancy Pelosi is going to be speaker for either 2 years or 4 years. She fought hard to get the gavel back. Is she going to give Trump his border wall? Is that going to be part of Speaker Pelosi's legacy? I think not, I think at least not if she can help it. So I don't see the off-ramp here. If the president stays dug in and the speaker stays dug in, I don't see the off-ramp. Somebody's going to have to blink at some point, but I don't see it.
You know, you mentioned the point that I've been befuddled by, for lack of a better description. I don't understand why part of Trump's strategy has not been, and maybe I've just missed it, to mention what you've mentioned, that early in, we were talking to Ali Nirani from the National Immigration Forum a couple of days ago, and we're talking about the fact that I think almost exactly a year ago, the Democrats, in return for a DACA deal, which I know Trump is now hesitant about because of Stephen Miller and Ann Coulter and whatever, the Democrats are willing to give him five times as much money for the wall. Why is Trump not throwing that in their face and saying it's really interesting that a year ago, he doesn't have to mention the other part of the equation, which obviously doesn't benefit him, the Dreamers thing, they were willing to give me $25 billion. Now they won't give me a nickel, which suggests, says President Trump, that it's not about policy, it's all about politics. Why haven't we heard that out of Trump or his minions?
You hear it out of his people a fair amount, saying his people would say, but the president, you're right, the president does not consistently make that message. He has on occasion said, they've been willing, the Democrats in the past have been willing to spend more on border security, and many Democrats, including Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama at one point, voted for a wall.
That's true.
Or at least structures along the border. The issue is, what the Democrats would say is, we were in the minority then, and we were trying to use what lever we were willing to give more, to get the DACA issue. Now, Nancy Pelosi says, sorry, Mr. President, you had your chance. We're in the majority now. We call the shots. 80% of the American people support protecting the Dreamers. 35% of the American people support building a wall. That's not an even trade. We're not giving you the wall for the Dreamers. No way.
I have one last question.
We're in charge now, so we don't have to give it to you.
Unrelating to the wall, like most Americans, well, I don't know most, a lot of people saw your colleague Anderson Cooper interviewing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on 60 Minutes the other night. And we had a debate on the show yesterday about how the leaders of the Democratic Party, the veterans, feel about someone who's so high profile going out and taking positions that are far more, to use her own word, radical than their mainstream positions. How do they react when someone with her profile and following talks about a 70% top marginal rate on the wealthiest taxpayers and other sorts of, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, I mean it descriptively, radical reform on climate change? They seem to be careful not to criticize her, with the exception of the Claire McCaskills of the world. How do the Pelosis and the Hoyers and the long-timers, the Richie Neals, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee now, how do they feel about her and other new kids on the block taking the kinds of positions they're taking?
Some of what they say makes them nervous from a national perspective, but they have to be very careful. There are a number of dynamics here. And, Jim, I think this is one of the most fascinating questions. We spent so much time on Trump. To me, this is one of the most fascinating questions of the next 2 years as the Democrats try to define themselves heading into 2020. You have all these new young voices, who many of them are impatient, and that's a compliment, not a criticism, who want to press their issues, who believe they won, in her case, a primary she wasn't supposed to win. Ayanna Pressley, right there in your backyard, a primary she wasn't supposed to win. So what are you supposed to do then? Be quiet? Tradition is you
wait your
become
turn.
A freshman, You shut up and wait your turn, or you wait till you have a little bit of seniority. This is a new generation. It's the new media age, the new social age. These are people who are not just politicians, but they come out of an activist background, where the activism drives them, not the title as much as the push and the momentum. And remember this. So if you're Nancy Pelosi, this can put you in a box, right? Impeach the president and even call him words that I'm not going to repeat on the radio in the daytime from one new freshman congresswoman. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says Medicare for all, maybe raise tax rates up to 70% on that $10 million or more people, things like that. So if you're Nancy Pelosi, it's like, okay, we're not going to vote on those things right now. If you're a Democrat running for Senate or governor in a purple state, that makes you cringe. However, Gavin Newsom, in his first day as governor of California yesterday, another progressive, says he wants to extend health care coverage to the undocumented, expand health care coverage for the undocumented. You can't sell that in Oklahoma. You can't sell that in Claire McCaskill's Missouri, but you can in California. When it comes to the national debate, I'll say this. Number one, where's the sweet spot is the question for Nancy Pelosi, in that she wants these people to be active. She got their votes by saying she will listen to them and advance as much of the agenda that is feasibly possible. She also knows that she's going to have national challenges from Democrats from parts of the country where you can't sell those liberal proposals. I will say this, though, that Nancy Pelosi is unique in this regard, in that she was a woman who was a young woman of Congress, was ambitious, both from a policy and a political perspective, who was told by the men, shut up and wait your turn. and so she has great patience. She has her own history tells her to tell these younger members, go for it. Just please check in with me. Be respectful. Don't surprise me. That's Nancy Pelosi's number one message. If you're going to go out and say something, give me a heads up, even if I disagree with it. Just don't surprise me. Don't pull the rug out from under me. And then I might have to say no sometimes. And you're going to have to understand when I say no. But let's try to find the sweet spot that you get to push your issues. You get to push your issues, and I get to do the math on what we can and cannot pass. But it's a fascinating dynamic as we go forward, because when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others say these things, every Democrat running for president is going to get asked about them. And the Republicans, when they can, will try to take advantage of the proposals that are viewed. And this is a big test for the country. Are these – is Medicare for all outside the mainstream? It used to be. That's why Walter – liberal policies like that is why Walter Mondale and Michael Dukakis got their butts kicked. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
What does the country want to do now? That's what 2020 and 2022 are going to be all about.
John, we have 10 seconds. Are you going to be at Gillette on Sunday?
I'm going to be here in my couch, resting and watching. Okay. And there might be a cold adult beverage involved. The King boys are going to sit on the couch and watch this one at home.
Enjoy the game. John,
John,
it's great
thank
to
you
talk
very
to you.
Much. John King joins
Amen.
Us every
I'm
week.
I'm rooting for Father Time. We can win this one.
John is CNN's chief national correspondent, the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8. Coming up. How does this government shutdown compare to others in United States history? Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our studio at the Boston Public Library. We're now joined by Harvard historian Nancy Kane. As you probably know, Nancy holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forging Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Hello, Nancy Kane.
Hey there, folks.
So you are going to tell us in the midst of this government shutdown about the history of government shutdowns.
So, let me refer all of us to this interesting and very concise, but still, historical article by two Washington Post writers. This was updated yesterday. It's called "The Shutdown is Already One of the Longest Ever. Here's How Others Ended," and it's basically a litany with a short explanation of all these. The writers are Kevin Shaul, S C H A U L, and Kevin Erchmacher, Erchmacher. And here's the skinny. So there have been about 12 shutdowns since the early 80s. There are other semi-shutdowns in the late 70s, but they were never, and this is an interesting point, taken very seriously by members of the government who were supposed to be shut down. In other words, things kept, kind of trolling along. Commerce Department, which is in charge of issuing a lot of government paychecks, kept issuing paychecks. So the threats to issue government shutdowns, calling for them, didn't have the kind of teeth that we're talking about here or in two other instances in the last 30 years until the late 1970s when the Attorney General ruled that you actually couldn't, once a government shutdown was in place, couldn't keep appropriating money without Congress legislating it, right, for constitutional reasons. So then government shutdowns took on a much higher stakes patina, or became much higher stakes. Two other big ones, we're now the second longest today, a 21-day shutdown during the Clinton administration.
21 days?
21 days over, and this is the interesting thing, so the litany of government shutdowns devolves into two camps, healthcare and budget, healthcare and large budget issues. So the Clinton shutdown in the mid-90s was a disagreement between House Republicans, Democrats controlled the Senate then, and the administration, the Office of Management and Budget, about what kind of numbers we were using to predict the government deficit. This is when Republicans, remember then, this, dear listeners and my colleagues, when Republicans were anti-deficit,
right,
and really trying to be fiscally conservative and disciplined about that. And there was a 21-day standoff, and eventually, doesn't sound like, from the little bit of research I did, doesn't sound like this. The repercussions were nearly as widespread in terms of the economy and society as they are here. National parks got closed. The Peace Corps was affected. Aid to families with dependent children, which bears some resemblance to SNAP, or aid to women and infants and children, another program that we haven't talked about today on the show that's been very seriously affected, that will be very seriously affected by the end of January, 7 million people in that versus 40 million in SNAP. In any event, it doesn't sound like the consequences were as great. The Republicans finally caved in the House and said, okay, we'll use your numbers. We're not going to get a deficit reduction omnibus bill, an agreement, and we're moving on. The next longest shutdown. Now we're ahead.
That was under which president?
That's Clinton.
That was Clinton. That's Clinton.
With Newt Gingrich running the House.
Right? Yes, exactly. Remember that whole very important, historically consistent train of Republican thought, which was deficits are bad.
Okay.
That's no longer part of the governing Republican ethos. The second longest shutdown, now we're the second longest, but the next longest shutdown was during Obama's administration, 2013, early 2013, 16 days. It was a standoff between basically Tea Party members who didn't want to support Obamacare and were digging their heels in. Again, another 700,000 government workers affected, national parks closed. The Obama administration, in contrast to the Trump administration, made the decision to close all the parks for safety reasons and just said, no national parks, they're not going to be open. And eventually, it came to be seen as a Republican shutdown, and Republicans viewed it as a liability and said, okay, we're going to just cave in and move on. So those two long shutdowns, budget, healthcare, and there's a number of other much shorter shutdowns, 3, 5, 1-day shutdowns, all falling into one of those camps, budget or healthcare, and not specific budget issues like a wall, omnibus budget issues about the size of the deficit.
Which arguably makes this one so much harder to settle, because I was going to say because it's concrete. I didn't mean that as a pun, but it is concrete.
Absolutely. It's it's very, very specific. So that's the rough lay of the land. What's interesting to me as someone who's done a lot of economic work is now how we're beginning to see the cascading consequence in which great difficulty, human suffering, but also organizational incapacitation is now begetting more and more and more. A couple of examples that we haven't talked about on the show today. I've been listening to the show since you started. If you're a farmer applying, get this, dear listeners, for an exemption or a loan to help you deal with Trump's trade war, because your household economics, your farm economics are going to be affected, you actually aren't going to see any money because your application can't be processed because the parts of the Department of Agriculture have closed down. You were talking about this in regard to aid to poor working families with Corby. If you're someone trying to get a taxpayer ID number, which you must have to do almost anything financial in this world, you can't get one because that part of the IRS is closed down. If you're trying to to, you know, to register for all kinds of different programs, even if they're not in the purview of the federal government. For example, you talked to this contractor, one of the call-ins top of the show, who said, I'm a contractor. I don't have any work right now. I'm going to have a backlog of work when it comes in, but I don't know when that's going to be. If you're someone, that, for example, who has your kids in a daycare center in a federal building, which turns out to be thousands and thousands of people, and that building is closed, you don't have daycare for your kids. So this is just now... The SEC is basically
That's
closed
right,
up shop
down here in, yeah. In Boston.
And of course, if you're serving businesses in areas of the country, and they're not just Washington, that have a lot of federal employees, your business is suffering. If you're trying to have an IPO, an initial public offering to raise cash, the SEC is closed down, so you're not going to be able to do that. If you're a big company or any size company trying to do a merger or an acquisition and need to do due diligence, which is all filtered through the Securities and Exchange Commission, that is not happening. The Department of Commerce will be late if it exists, if it's able to at all, produce things like different kinds of key economic indicators, housing starts, consumer confidence. So Deutsche Bank issued yesterday a warning and on guidance for all kinds of investors saying, America may not be able to provide, the government may not be able to provide the information that we consider essential to making sound investment decisions. The Fed has recently raised a slightly hesitant flag about Fed policy because it's not clear they'll have the economic data they need. So this is now starting at every level. Let's not get away from the individual suffering and uncertainty that people are living with, at least 800,000 people. But if we start adding in SNAP and WIC recipients, we're talking about 50 million people. This is without people wanting a tax refund. Even without that, we're now starting to have the chaos of all these different issues, right, now cascading. And the federal government, particularly the executive branch's inability to anticipate these and band-aid for them sufficiently, now beginning to have macroeconomic effects. It's a big deal.
And this is different than what went on just in the Obama administration, even though it was a quite lengthy one, too.
Yes. I think the couple of things make it different. First, my sense based on limited research on the Obama shutdown was that the federal government and the executive branch had a pretty good idea of what needed to happen very quickly if the shutdown went on, like closing the national parks.
Okay.
Or figuring out how to stopgap funding for aid to families with dependent children.
Yep.
So the band-aids that administration had in terms of the knowledge of these different agencies or organizations seemed to be higher, and its application of remedies much more efficient. That's the first thing that's different. Second thing that's different is that the economy itself is actually more connected than it was 6 years ago in 2013.
What do you mean?
For all kinds of reasons. Well, we're more connected technologically.
Oh, okay.
Right? So the reverberations of things are felt much more quickly. You want to apply for a tax ID number, you actually expect to get it online in a number of days.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen right now.
Okay.
So what that means is that then not being able to do that, not being able to get a bank account, you can't get a bank account if you don't have a tax ID number and you're a small business, is immediately going to start affecting your own economic well-being and other parties that are connected to that economic well-being. So just like we talk over and over on this show about how connectivity has done a bunch of things in society, here it's actually exacerbating the deleterious consequences of this shutdown in the economy. And it soon will have global effects.
Well, so as we've learned, not just from you, but from people through the years, that the thing business community hates worse than a particular policy is uncertainty about policy. No one has any idea what's going to happen here. And the president said the other day, this could go on as long, even though that's not very plausible, Right. It could go on as long as years, this shutdown. And obviously, as you've described, the impact begins to spread further and further out to more people in and out of government.
Absolutely. I just read something today in the New York Times about manufacturers who are applying for exemptions for metal tariffs on metal that they use to produce goods. Those are inputs to their production processes. They can't apply right now because that part of the government is shut down. So if you start thinking about this, not only from the 800,000 workers who are working without pay, the morale problem of the Secret Service, the TSA members calling in sick, the IRS workers working without pay, the commerce workers working without pay to issue some paychecks. If you start thinking about it, what does that mean for lots of smaller organizations that are trying to make their way in our economy? It really becomes a much, much bigger and much, much more destructive moment in our country's history right now.
Nancy, thanks as
Nancy
always.
Nancy Kane, that was great. Thank you very much. Nancy Kane is a Harvard historian. She joins us every week. She holds a James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you to people at the library here. We really appreciate people stopping by to see us. You can catch us anytime, 24/7, by way of our podcast. In the App Store or on iTunes. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by our medical ethicist Art Kaplan, Jared Bowen, Salem's Mayor Kim Driscoll is going to talk about the marijuana store that just entered her city. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, our on-site engineer, Ron Milton, and all the folks at the Newsfeed Cafe who give us delicious food. What is on television, Jim?
Well, Brody? I continued our conversation from last week with Dean Strang and Jerry Buting, the two lawyers featured in season one of Making a Murderer. They've taken some heat from the lead lawyer for Stephen Avery in season two. I'm going to talk to them about that, about what happens to Avery and Dassey, and also their criminal justice reform campaign. And secondly, one of your favorites, Ferris Stockman, Pulitzer Prize winner now,
The
New York Times, and Glenn Johnson. Remember Glenn at the Globe, Associated Press, covered five presidential campaigns. Then he left to be the press person for John Kerry, as Secretary of State, for his tenure. He's back. He's got a book coming out. It's called Window Seat on the World. Glenn and Farrah are going to preview tonight's speech by the president. So we'll do that as well.
He is Jim Brody.
I am Jim Brody.
That's right. I am Marjorie
Egan. You're Marjorie
Egan. Thank you very much for tuning in.
See you tomorrow.
Please tune in tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.
Bye.